It's November 22nd. It's November 29th, 2006. This is the House Interim Task Force on DHS Review. We appreciate everyone who's willing to come in and be part of this meeting today. To begin, we assume that the rest of this committee, our task force, will join us as we go along, but let's just go ahead and begin our agenda with a presentation on SpeakRight Internet Transcription Service with Richard Jackson and Jim Neely.
Chair Richardson, members of the committee, I'm Doug Barber here on behalf of SpeakRight today. SpeakRight is a tool that can be used by caseworkers in child welfare to make them more effective and efficient in their job. With me today is Richard Jackson, the president of the company, here from Austin, Texas. Richard?
Good morning.
Hello.
Chair Richardson, members of the committee, I am Richard Jackson, president of SpeakRight. Sorry about this voice. I can't seem to do anything with it here, so I'll try to squeak my way through. This is also my first time to ever testify before a committee like this, so I'm going to do what I think you want me to do, and then if you need some more information, let me know, and I'll try to do that. SpeakRight is a company that was created in 1997 to perform off-site transcription services to various clients of our company around the country. Initially, we did work for lawyers and law firms, whereby those members of those firms could dictate documents, correspondence, pleadings, or whatever, which was then routed by our computer system out to transcriptionists that worked for us all over the U.S., but all in the U.S., no offshore transcriptionists, and no voice recognition software. These are all live transcriptionists doing this work. When there's a number of ways that they can do that work, but they would dial into a toll-free telephone number, dictate what they wanted transcribed. One of our transcriptionists would transcribe it, another would proofread it, and it would come back to them as an email attachment in their software in about an hour, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. We did that for several years, and then we discovered that there was an application for this in the Child Protective Services arena, in that there are large numbers of caseworkers that go out and make on-site visits to people who are in need of investigations or help. And these caseworkers were going out making these visits, usually making handwritten notes of what their findings were, then going back at the end of the day and trying from those notes to recall the details of the visits and generating reports. They told us, we began this in Florida for their children and families, then in Texas, and have done some work in Oregon. They tell us that they consistently spend, per caseworker, about 2 hours per day doing this paperwork. By using our service, they're able to take a telephone, either a cell phone or any other kind of phone, call in and dictate those reports live as they finish their investigations, and then at the end of the day, their paperwork is all done for them, comes back to their email, and therefore it gets them out of the paperwork business, gives them a more live, current, real-time report, which they tell us is more detailed, and keeps the caseworkers working on their cases instead of doing casework. We have done this now, and there's some handouts that we prepared so that you could see some of the scope of this. But as an overview, we've done this in Florida since 1999, I believe. We've done it in Texas for the Child Protective Services there on a large-scale basis since 2005. And there, in that information, it's demonstrated that this turnaround time is consistently, as I said, we've done something in the neighborhood of 300 or 320,000 case reports for the Texas child and family with an average turnaround time of less than an hour. And these are people that are doing work around the clock like that. We also did some work for the Florida, or the Oregon Child Protective Services in 2004. did a pilot program from them, had good feedback from the users and from the agency there in terms of the results, and did a small and short-term contract with them, which was then scheduled to be the subject of an RFP, but then there were some funding difficulties and didn't go further beyond that. So we've had some specific time on the ground in Oregon. We've had a good deal of specific time, or specific experience in providing this to other state government child protective services. It has the effect of simply allowing those workers to spend more time in the field doing what they are there to do rather than doing that paperwork. It also has the net effect of buying back that time of the workers so that you get more work from them, requiring less net workers that you'd have to have otherwise. So there's a cost savings element into it as well. There are some studies and some results that I've given you there that that illustrate that the cost of having this work done by our company versus the cost of having the work done by the workers themselves represents a substantial savings just in the out-of-pocket expenditure, but it also gives them that time back to cover the caseloads. If anybody has any other questions, I'll be glad to answer them. I realize this is a new concept. There's really no other organization in the country that does what we do. We currently do this for about something in excess of 30,000 users nationwide. And so that's the gist of what I wanted to tell you.
Would you address the security issues?
Yes, sir. Because of the work that we do for the attorneys, the security and confidentiality was an issue from the start, obviously. So we have done several things to address that. We have each of these transcriptionist contractors enter into confidentiality and non-disclosure agreements with us so that they're aware of the nature and the confidentiality of what they do. But these are also contractors that work independently from around the country with no contact with each other or ability to identify or contact each other, so they couldn't compare notes or follow the progress of a case. When they are assigned a job to do, they're not made aware of who the client is or what state they're from or any other identifying information other than what's contained in the content of the report itself. We have gone through HIPAA compliance examinations in all of the states where we do business, so we're HIPAA compliant in terms of any sort of requirements in that regard. And as I said, we've been doing this now since 1997 for attorneys for state government agencies. We actually do this for a number of other agencies besides the Child Protective Services in Texas, and then a number of other clients unrelated to those, and we've never had any incident of anyone misusing any of the information or making any improper use of confidential or protected information.
No complaints is a good record.
I'm sorry?
No complaints.
No complaints.
That's a good record.
That's a good record. And we do a large number of these. As I said, we have a large number of clients, and many of them, such as these state government agencies, I think we've done all of the work for all of the Texas Health and Human Service Department there now for a year and a half. So this is over a large body of experience. We've had no complaints.
Any questions? Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Chair Richard. Are your workers based in the United States?
Yes, sir. All of them are in the United States, have been from inception, and we would not have any that were not based in the U.S. These are all people with extensive experience in word processing. We have specially trained legal transcriptionists for the work done for lawyers that require that, but otherwise all of them have substantial amount of experience in word processing. We check them as you would other employees, had checked their references, checked their background, checked their experience, and then they go through a testing and training period with us before they ever do any work. We have also, in case there's an interest in it, we have taken surveys of the users in the Texas Child Protective Service. We have several thousand caseworkers there that use it, and we did a survey of them, to which about 1,000 of them responded, and I have a copy of the results of that survey. I also have the survey on some CDs that contain the same information. It describes their time saved during the day, their use of the product, what they think it does for them in terms of the quality of the product. They say they get a dramatically better and more detailed report when they're able to generate that more or less real time rather than waiting to the end of the day or the end of the week, I don't know, and trying to reconstruct their notes. So I have those available if anybody is interested in those as well. So
if we could have a copy of that, we would appreciate having
it. Yes, sir.
Are there any other questions from Mr. Jackson? Thank you very much, Mr. Neely.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Jim Neely, Deputy Assistant Director for DHS. I would just add a little bit to what Mr. Jackson has said. Indeed, we did a pilot with his company when they were known as Cyber Secretaries, and began with child welfare field staff. And very quickly, this program became popular amongst the field staff, and in fact, also it began getting requests to use it from our self-sufficiency or temporary assistance to needy families staff. We found that the majority of folks were actually using their office telephones to make this contact, although they also used cell phones if they were waiting in court or out with a client. And in some areas of the state where the cell phone reception is iffy, they actually used digital voice recorders and then replayed those when they got back to the office to the service. I provided you some information from a survey that we took at the end of this. Most people felt that they were doing a better job, able to spend more time with clients, and of the 82% who said it helped them get more work done, about 83% of those reported saving up to 9 hours a week, and 17% reported saving up to 15 hours per week. So it was very popular, and unfortunately, as we came to the end of the initial period and hoped to continue it, we were in a budget situation that really didn't allow for us to do that. But we remain very interested in this and any other technologies that enable us to do exactly what Mr. Jackson said in terms of getting caseworkers away from the paperwork or reducing the paperwork and getting them back together with the clients.
Where do you plan to go from here as far as DHS is concerned?
Mr. Chair, one of the things that we've been looking at in while I believe there are cost savings available here, when we did our initial pilot, it really was to try and figure out whether or not folks would use the service. And so we really didn't set it up to measure the cost savings of it. I remain convinced that we may be able to make a case that as we look at overtime, and we spend a fair amount of dollars in overtime during the biennium, that if we were to use this service, we could cut back on that overtime to the extent that it literally would pay for itself. We haven't been able to pencil that out yet because, as I mentioned, we didn't really set the survey up or the pilot up to test that, but we're still looking for ways to pay for this kind of technology.
So is the conclusion that you like it, but that you're not going anywhere with it because at this point you don't know if you can afford it?
Mr. Chair, I would say that's a pretty good summary. We like it very much, but because of our very tight budget situation, we haven't been able to afford it.
Thank you. Any questions? Appreciate very much. It sounds like good use of technology, and I know of law firms that have used this for years. Thanks very much for coming in. We appreciate you taking the time to come and
well, thank
explain
you
this.
For taking the time to listen to us. Thank you.
Yep.
Next, we have update and discussion on the use of the Federal Deficit Reduction Act, DRA, and its impact and implementation in DHS. Todd? On Dave Light is coming up, too.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Committee. My name is Vic Todd. I'm the administrator for the self-sufficiency programs in the Children's, Adults, and Families Division. And with me is Dave Lida, the TANF program manager. And what we wanted to do was to briefly go through several displays. You should have a display that is labeled TANF. What is it? The Oregon Temporary Assistance Needy Families Program, two-page display, and then a, I believe it's eight-page display that is actually the full document that was produced out of the work of an oversight committee. So I wanted to begin just kind of quickly doing a brief review of what is TANF, and TANF is the acronym for Temporary Assistance Needy Families Program. That program was created in originally 1996 as a result of federal legislation that essentially replaced the old aid to families for or aid to families for dependent children. In Oregon, the TANF program currently provides feedback. I'm sorry.
They're calling now. I'm not sure what
to about 18,000 families, and that includes about 41,000 people and a little over 30,000 children. Of important note that about 95% of these families have essentially zero income, and which is a feature that has long been there. Additionally, about 35% of the cases do not have an adult in the case. For various reasons, and so that's an important element in terms of the connection to the child welfare system as well, in that a large or significant portion of children move from the TANF program to child welfare for various reasons. The different types of assistance that are provided include a cash grant. And for a family of three, the maximum grant level is about $514. That's about 35% of the federal poverty level income guidelines. In addition to the cash grant, then there are basic services that are provided through the jobs program. And I won't go through each one of those, but you can see that list there. And then generally, these families are also well, they're all eligible for food stamps, and generally they all are receiving food stamps and are eligible for medical services through Medicaid. I say generally because not all of them avail themselves to that for different reasons.
You're saying, though, that if you qualify for TANF, you qualify for the Oregon Health Plan automatically?
Yes. On the second page of that display, there's a summary around that's called TANF, What's Changing. Essentially, when the TANF program was created, it changed from a federal program that matched state contributions to a program that uses a block grant concept and then uses a methodology that requires the state to contribute a fixed amount, a fixed minimum amount, and that's referred to as maintenance of effort. And part of that change in terms of moving from a matched program to a block grant program was to grant states more flexibility with respect to design of their programs. And so states went about that and had a lot of latitude in the first round, if you will, of the PERORA legislation, which was the welfare reform that created TANF. Most recently, the Deficit Reduction Act of 2005 was signed in February of 2006, and that made a couple of significant changes or caused a couple of significant changes to occur. The first item there under the bullets talks about the participation requirements. And while those are not new participation requirements in that the all-family rate at 50% and the two-parent rate at 90% Those existed in the original legislation. What changed in the legislation was direction that was given to the federal government to actually provide definitions around what types of activities would count in determining if you met those participation requirements. And that those changes in terms of the rules that were issued in June of this year came through in a fairly constrictive way in that in terms of the activities that a state could now count towards meeting those participation requirements were fairly guided towards work-related only activities in terms of whether they would be accountable activity. So that presented a lot of challenges for states in terms of how they were going to do their program designs, and we'll talk a little bit more about that in a minute. The other significant change was with respect to what's referred to as a caseload reduction credit. In the original legislation, the base year for determining how you could adjust the level of participation that you had achieved in terms of that 50% rate, for example, you would take the caseload change that had occurred since 1995 to the current point in time and reduce the participation rate you needed to achieve on a percent for percent basis. So if your caseload went down 10%, your all-family rate would effectively go from 50 to 40%. In this Deficit Reduction Act, and so that provided a lot of latitude around how programs could be designed because you, as you effectively reduce your caseload, that contributed to your participation rate achievement. When the Deficit Reduction Act passed, they changed the base year from 1995 to 2005. And so that effectively wiped out the impact of having a caseload reduction credit. And so that's another factor that I think is causing states to, you know, take a strong relook at how have they designed their programs and what it is they're going to do to meet those rates going forward. So, any questions that the committee has? Okay. The second display that you have.
Representative Wisner?
Thank you. Mr. Todd, I don't know if you're going to talk about it later, but you know, the main thing is what's the impact going to be on the forecast, right? Are you going to talk about these changes? Do they impact significantly the forecasting work? Or?
Mr. Chair, Representative Wisner, it will affect, ultimately it will have some impact on what is the overall caseload. However, with what we will be proposing to do going forward, that traditional caseload count will have a different look to it in terms of how we're going to propose structuring this program going forward. So that might become clearer as we go along.
Okay. Thank you. One more follow-up. Thank you. Mr. Tuck, your forecast, the fall forecast, indicated 8% predicted decrease in TNAF, right?
I believe that's correct.
So it doesn't sound like it's a problem. It's a good problem if it's going to decrease your workload 8% in that area.
Representative Richardson and Representative Resnott, the forecast does not at this point incorporate any anticipated impacts from the reauthorization. So that is just purely based upon our existing program.
By way of clarification, the requirements of work participation are a challenge, am I correct, because the easiest families to get work are either working now or are off of TANF, and that over a period of time we've come from like 44,000 families down to roughly 15 or 16,000. We're back to 18, I believe. And many of these people are people that were not intended to be on a temporary assistance to needy family while you get a job program, but are essentially long-term disabled people that really don't have any reasonable hope of actually getting a job. And so they're here because they get the benefits, but with the requirements that the intent of TANF be re-implemented to get people to work, it puts DHS in a situation where they have to say, do these people even belong on TANF? Should they be someplace else? And if so, where would that be? And as long as they're on TANF and they're unable to get a job, it's going to affect our ability to meet these requirements for employment participation. And so you've got a conundrum. Is that correct?
Chair Richardson, that's you've described it very well. I think that what this passage has done in terms of it's almost a shock treatment that this state's, I'll just speak for Oregon, had to step away from this and really look at what is this program and what is it that the federal government has now defined this program to be, and what are the populations that are currently in this program, and how should it be structured so that you are providing services to these clients appropriately, and then at the same time trying to achieve those federal requirements.
In all fairness, so the federal requirements have basically been the same. I mean, but now we're talking about implementing them, and the purpose for passing TANF by Congress was to move away from a permanent entitlement mentality for welfare to a temporary assistance to help people transition through a crisis period. But many of the states, including Oregon, over the period of time have it's found it hard to change. And so what they've essentially done is allow a large number of people to be in TANF as a long-term plan, although it was intended initially that there would be a certain number of years and then you would have to be off, but Oregon kind of got a waiver on that, and so we've had people on TANF for a long time. And so this is an opportunity for us to re-evaluate how Oregon functions in a program that's designed to help people get jobs when, in many cases, it's become a program for long-term welfare recipients. Am I correct?
Chair Richardson, essentially that is correct. I think that it's the issue. Some of the issue is that there isn't another avenue for some of those clients in terms of their disability and where else could they go in terms of a program. And so what we're looking at is trying to design a program that gives them that avenue, recognizing that you can, in fact, downstream from that, work with them towards an employment, but it's a different stream.
We have roughly 15 minutes left for this portion of our agenda. Can you use that time to help us see the changes that TANF is taking, the recommendations DHS is going to be making that will have people that shouldn't be on TANF identified and be where they ought to be, or just how will this change the way that DHS functions in this area?
Okay. Yes, Chair Richardson. I'm going to attempt to do that in this display, the second display. The first piece here is, and I've already talked about it a little bit, and that is that we're looking at this more as an opportunity to reevaluate. And so that's that first piece. The second piece there around background and planning efforts, I just wanted to mention briefly that with the passage of the Deficit Reduction Act and its signing, the federal government then moved fairly quickly in terms of developing interim final rules and sent those out in the last day of June, essentially. And so that gave us then the place to start our real discussions about how we were going to do our planning. And so we went through an internal process of talking about what are the strengths and weaknesses of our existing program, what are the client groups that are within our program, and how should they, be dealt with most effectively, et cetera. We formed a TANF oversight committee that included legislators, including you, Mr. Chair, and advocacy groups, internal departmental folks, as well as other agencies, to look at this from the standpoint of both services to clients as well as you know, how do we work with other state agencies and local agencies to help people become self-sufficient? From that, we produced this, the larger document that you have, that talks about the various aspects that we're going to pursue. This two-page document summarizes that. And essentially, the basic design of what we are proposing is really a four-piece approach to this, in that we would have a pre-TANF program element that really essentially is focused on doing an assessment, a more in-depth evaluation of the family's needs, and, you know, testing of labor market and so forth for those that it's appropriate to. Within that piece of the program, a case plan would be developed for those that are going to require a more extensive service set, so that we can move forward with that immediately as they move on to TANF. Within the ongoing TANF, then we would also expand the service set that's available for these clients, again working towards moving them to self-sufficiency, and also for those families that employment really is not an option in a short time window, the focus would be on the family stability issues. As I mentioned, a large portion of children move from TANF to foster care, and so we want to be sure that we're doing as much as we can to ensure that the families don't end up in that scenario. So it's more of almost a cost avoidance in some ways, as foster care is much more expensive in terms of a program.
Would you mind taking just a minute and go in a little more depth there as to what you actually will be doing to help families stay together and not have to have a situation where the kids are going to foster care?
Mr. Chair, I believe it's really more of the issue of doing more in-depth analysis of what are their circumstances and providing services, including expanding A&D related activities and so forth. The third element is what we're referring to as post-employment TANF, and this element of the program is really to deal with the issue of recidivism, in that often when a family does become employed, the initial frustrations that they face are around stabilizing their ability to sustain their employment. So whether it's a child care issue or bills or the fact that they won't be paid for several weeks, there are just a whole host of things that go on when they transition. We have done this in the past, although in a more limited fashion, but during the past several years with the budgetary issues that we faced, that portion of the existing program has been reduced. And so what we have seen is an increase in recidivism. And so this element would help help families sustain that employment. That's the desired outcome here. And so this portion of the program would be available to those families that find employment either in the pre-TANF portion of the program or as part of the ongoing TANF. And we would have that available to them for up to 12 months in the current proposal. The last piece here is what we're referring to as their state-only MOE, non-MOE programs, and what we're calling the state SSI program is really a program element that we would put in place that strengthens the ability of the self-sufficiency programs to address those clients that actually have disabilities and should be on an SSI track. And so this would be a state-only non-MOE program meaning that it would not count towards federal criteria. And so this would be a voluntary option for mandatory clients that we, after we have done an evaluation and an assessment and have determined that they should be on an SSI track, that we would move them to this and then strengthen our ability to shorten that window to get them eligible for SSI. And right now that's an issue for us in terms of the length of time that it takes for us to get people through that process. This program element would contain an agreement process that we would recoup those funds that the state spends on providing benefits for the adult once the adult becomes eligible for SSI. There's no impact to the client in that currently what happens is that the federal government looks at what benefits have they received to date under TANF and deducts that from the award that they get. So in this instance, that would not occur, and for the client there would be no change in outcome. It's just that would be paid back to the state in terms of a interim agreement process.
President Flores.
Thank you. So for clarification, you're talking about folks that who will be in the category of requiring assistance, but more than temporary. They're going moving them from the temporary category into ongoing, and that would be in the SSI category.
Chair Richardson, Representative Flores, yes, that's correct. And so as far as the children, from a children's standpoint, that benefit would still occur. So they would be treated as a no-parent household, essentially. So it is the adult's portion that is really related to the SSI grant in terms of that interim assistance agreement. And so that is the intent, is that you would pull them out of the TANF program, if you will, and put the client into an SSI pursuit, is really program. And then once that's established, be looking at how do you work with that client to pursue employment. Because it's not as though that their employment can't be an outcome, but they need a set of services that the TANF program itself is not really the right place for them to be.
If they were good in word processing and could work from their home, we have this program that we could maybe tie them in.
The other piece that we want to address in as we move forward in our proposal is the two-parent TANF program, the TANF UN program, has a participation rate requirement of 90%, and that is fairly unachievable. And so what we are proposing to do is to take that portion of the two-parent family population and create a state-only program, have the same exact requirements and so forth, but just treat it as a state-only program. Would not have to be faced with a penalty as a result of not achieving a 90% participation rate. So it's more of a behind the scenes for clients. They won't know the difference. It's the same program.
We have two programs, one in TANF for those that are working and one out, or just essentially not have two parent homes in the TANF program?
Chair Richardson, you would have a two parent program in TANF, and then you would have a state only two parent program. But they essentially are the same program. It's just that from a funding standpoint, they would be treated differently.
Meaning those that where you can't meet the 90% will be out of general fund and not be seeking a match and therefore won't be part of the percentage requirement that TANF has.
Exactly. other changes that are needed and were proposed through this process was the first item there was to raise.
For a moment.
Oh, I'm
Representative
sorry.
Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Your question triggered another one from me, if I may. What you say we can't meet the 90% requirement. What is your experience so far on the what percentage are you able to do as you understand it now?
Chair Richardson, Representative Barnhart, currently we are at about 17-18% as a participation rate with the current program, and as the all family rate, and within that is the two parent piece. The issue that I think we really face is that the constraints in terms of what counts as an activity essentially prevents you from achieving that, because the issues that are associated with, you know, barrier removals, if you will, are very time constrained in terms of being able to actually do anything. And so most of the time that would be spent in a long-term activity would not be accountable activity. And so it sets you up for not being able to achieve that outcome if you're actually trying to deal with the issues that the clients are facing.
So if I may, it sounds as though what you're saying, without actually saying it, is that the federal requirements may look really good on paper, but in fact they can't work in the real world.
Sure.
I don't expect you to respond to that question, but that's what it does sound like you're saying.
Well, we can mention that in the federal budget they did lower some of the funding because of expected failure to comply.
Right.
So yeah, it was factored in.
None of that surprises me very much, Mr. Chair. Thank you. I have some other questions, but I'll hold off on them because they're not on this topic.
Thank you. Representative Farr.
Very quickly. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you give a couple of examples, or are they enumerated somewhere, of the activities that you're referring to, the required activities?
Chair Richardson, Representative Flores, for the record, my name is Dave Lida. I'm the TANF manager for DHS. The federal government set up 12 activities, some of which they consider core, which is they count toward the first 20 hours of required participation, and some non-core activities as well. The lead activity one of the activities is actually working. And so now within Oregon, because of our grant structure, you can't meet the participation rate for, say, a family of three and still be on TANF because of our minimum wage and our gross income test. Another activity would be doing work experience. So if you were to volunteer or do those kind of activities in either a state agency or a community organization, that would count as a core activity. Job search and job readiness is another activity. And so basically you're either looking for work or dealing with, kind of those workplace basics. You kind of learn what's expected around showing up to work on time, calling in if you're sick, kind of those things that are just kind of basic to anyone that's employed. Within that, there's also the ability now to do some limited A&D, mental health, and those kind of services. There's some vocational training, and that's time limited. That's also an allowable activity. Now, for that first 20 hours, now for the teen parents that have not got their GED or their high school diploma, going to school is an allowable activity as well. Kind of in that second tier, you pick up a few other things like continuing it or adult basic education for that second 10 hours of required participation, and job skills, where it may not be vocational education, but it's other kind of short-term training things that folks can do. There's also some community work experience, which they define it differently in the regulations, but it's really within the kind of broader sense of work experience, which is also one of those first-tier core activities. There's also within, I forgot the other core activity, if you were to provide daycare for someone that's in community work experience, the core activities also include that activity, but that's fairly limited, and there's some parameters around that. I think that's most of them.
And a quick follow-up? Then, and what you're giving me is the information or the criteria that currently exist that qualify. And what is the tightening? What is the pressure that what's eliminated from the list of qualifying activities?
Chair Richardson, Representative Flores, I'll give you an example of kind of how they've tightened things. They've put the activities related to, say, mental health and alcohol and drug treatment and services and in a category that is time limited within the regulation. So that particular activity is put in with job search and job readiness, which under the regulations can only be provided for 6 weeks in a year, and only 4 of those can be consecutive. Now, we're considered a needy state because of our high food stamp recipient rate, and so they expanded that to 12 weeks within a year. But by putting it into that one category, it really, really limits your ability to provide long-term barrier removal services because of that time constraint. Because if you, at least the way that the regulations were written, If you count an activity for an hour, that counts for the week. And so that would be one example. Another example would be looking at the use of unsupervised homework. And the regulations themselves more or less banned unsupervised homework as being an allowable kind of hour-for-hour activity. Now, we've asked for some amendments to that in our work verification plan. But, I mean, those are just a couple of examples.
Thank
you. I don't
know if
you had. That university attendance does not count. I mean, this is job vocational training would, but going to college would not. It's viewed as a general thing, but not job-specific. And so it really is designed to help people go to work and get to work, and when you're dealing with a population that have many barriers, behavioral, physical, mental, that would prevent them from getting a job, it's the challenge that is being faced.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Would you like to?
One quick question. Does DHS contracts with federal government for SSI eligibility? Can we provide that?
Yeah. Chair Richardson, Representative Hansen. DHS has disability termination services that do that initial eligibility criteria, and that's located within Seniors and People with Disabilities Division.
Would there be any advantage for us to either supplement that effort? One of the frustrating things working with constituents is trying to get them through the SSI process. Mm-hmm. And it's long, time-consuming. Would there be any advantage to us in strengthening adding to that contract to help speed the processing?
Chair Richardson, Representative Hansen, we are looking at ways to strengthen that process, both through adding resource and working with SSA. They're interested as well in creating that other stream in terms of you know, determining the eligibility more rapidly and then getting people into a stream that does move them to employment. You know, even though they've been put into SSI with a disability, that doesn't mean they cannot become employed. And so they're interested in working with us as well on this. So we are pursuing that.
Other questions? Would you like to wrap up?
Chair Richardson, yes, I know we've taken more time than we were supposed to. And so we would be happy to meet with any of you to go a little bit more in depth on this. And with that, I won't go through the last piece there under other changes. You can just close that. With that, thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. I invite Clyde Seike and Karen House to come forward. Good morning.
Good morning. Chair Richardson and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Clyde Seike. I'm the Deputy Director for Operations for the Department of Human Services. And with me at the table is Karen House, who is the Self-Sufficiency Medical Program Manager for the Children, Adult, and Families Division. We're here this morning to update you on the implementation of the Proof of Citizenship Requirement for the Federal Deficit Reduction Act. And, Mr. Chair, if it meets with your approval, I'd like to take just a few minutes to talk about the requirement itself, and then I'll turn it over to Ms. House, who will talk about our implementation efforts.
Thank you.
Okay. You should have a handout that's entitled Deficit Reduction Act, Proof of Citizenship Requirements. On the first page, it just basically says or tells you that the Deficit Reduction Act of 2005 requires all individuals who are applying or recertifying for certain Medicaid benefits who state that they are U.S. citizens to prove their citizenship. In the past, the requirement was that we could use a self-declaration by the applicant or recipient that they were U.S. citizens to meet that requirement. So the change is now they have to prove citizenship as well as identity to receive the benefits. On the second page, it just talks about only certain Medicaid programs are impacted by this act. And it really is not a new requirement. It's really more a change in process or a strengthening of the process to meet the requirement.
Would you take a moment and tell us which programs that are administered by DHS do not require citizenship?
I think probably one you're most familiar with is the CALM program, the Citizen Alien Waiver and Emergency Medical. I think we also have some other programs, Medicaid programs, where you can be a documented non-citizen and receive some Medicaid services. Karen probably knows that a little better than I do.
Chair Richardson and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Karen House, and I am the Children, Adults, and Families Self-Sufficiency Medical Program Manager. And the COWM is our one program where...
Would you go ahead and define that, since there's people watching?
Certainly. The Citizen Alien Waived Emergency Medical Program, that is the one program where if a person is not a citizen, where they can receive for medical benefits for emergency purposes only, as long as they meet all the other criteria.
For clarification on this Citizen Alien Waiver Emergency Medical Program, this is a federal program.
Yes.
What is there Oregon general funds involved in that, or is that a fully funded by federal dollars?
Mr. Chair, it's like any other Medicaid program where there's a state portion and a federal portion.
Okay.
And one of the things I would add is that and I think you've already pointed out, is that we are required to run that program if we have a Medicaid program within the state of Oregon by the federal government.
Okay. I don't think you've mentioned CHIP. Is CHIP one of those programs that would cover children that are not legally in Oregon?
Chair Richardson, no, the CHIP program is for children that are citizens. That is, when you mention it, that is one of the programs that is not required to provide citizenship documentation. They still need to be self-declare, but they do not have to provide the documentation.
Okay. Other than those two programs, are there any other programs that either are self-declared or do not require citizenship?
Chair Richardson, yes, there are. If we have a person that is receiving both Medicaid and Medicare, or if they're receiving supplemental security income, the SSI, those individuals are not required to provide the citizenship documentation either. And, well, under the assumption that they have already provided that proof.
Okay. All right. I don't want to get too burdened there. I just wanted to touch on those and then have us move forward.
And just one other point of clarification, Representative or Chair Richardson, is that for people who qualify for the CAL-1 program, they still have to meet, although they don't have to meet the citizenship requirement, they still have to meet the Medicaid eligibility requirements to receive the service. So I just thought I'd toss that in there. Oregon implemented the new requirement on September 1st, 2006, for all programs except our Family Planning Expansion Project program, which is run out of the Public Health Department. We had some issues there with data systems and some other challenges because of the people who deliver the services. Those services are delivered through local organizations rather than DHS staff. And so it took us a little longer and to implement the requirement for that program, but we fully implemented for the FPEP program, Family Planning Expansion Project, on November 1st. So we have now fully implemented the requirement for that program also. If you look on the third page, it just kind of briefly talks about the kinds of documents that are acceptable to prove citizenship and identity. The federal government really set up kind of a hierarchy that gave levels of credibility, I guess you could say. In other words, documents at the top of the list were considered the most desirable and are the ones that we should seek first, and then it kind of work your way down the list to the bottom where it's, I think, at the bottom for citizenship, there's affidavit process where someone can bring in two other people who are citizens to attest to the fact that they are citizens themselves. On the bottom of page 3, it talks about the kinds of documents that are acceptable: birth certificates, hospital records, military records, certain medical records, and insurance or nursing facility records. On page 4, we provided you with some of the items that you can use to prove identity, because the requirement is that you not only prove citizenship, but you also have to prove your identity. And those would be the four of the things listed on the bottom of page 4: driver's license, DMV ID card, U.S. military ID card, and school ID card with the photo.
President Hanson.
Couple quick questions just on the documentation. Adoption papers for a child that was born outside the United States but's adopted by, do those count? Because I'm working with a constituent that was adopted from Korea,
mm-hmm.
and her citizenship was immediate at the point of the adoption. But the birth record, of course, is from Korea. And so kind of the naturalization, the birth certificate, all of that really was wrapped up in one action of when she was adopted. And that's been a struggle in a couple cases in terms of getting official, getting driver's licenses. And
sure.
And it was a very timely thing to go back and get the adoption records from 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Chair Richardson and Representative Hanson, I believe that the adoption papers are considered acceptable documentation. I did bring the hierarchical list with me. I can look at that and maybe provide that.
Yeah. The other question is on the driver's licenses and the picture ID. Is there any requirement that those have to be of the digital? The newer driver's licenses are digital photos that are much easier for DMV to compare. But I'm thinking in terms of some of our older citizens who haven't driven for a long time or who didn't have a student car with a picture on it when they graduated from high school in 1940. Is that a problem, or does any photo ID work?
Chair Richardson and Representative Hansen, any motor vehicle's driver's license that was issued in the state of Oregon would be acceptable as documentation. Yes, it does not, in the rules it does not get that specific, so yes, we can accept that. Same with passports, for example. A passport can be expired, and we can still accept that.
Thank you. Yeah, Chair Richardson and Representative Hansen, I think as we have implemented this act and are living under it as we go along, we're going to find those kinds of examples that you've raised. And as soon as we get those kinds of situations, we immediately talk to our federal partners. And other states are experiencing the same thing. And so far, they've been pretty receptive to talking to us about, well, what about this and what about this situation? At this time, Chair Richardson, I'd like to turn it over to Ms. House, and she'll talk a little bit about implementation.
Okay. On page 2, where it talks about valid driver's license, that means driver's license that was valid at some time in history, not a current valid driver's license. Is that right?
Chair Richardson, I believe that's correct, yes.
Ms. Kapoor.
I'm going to start on page 3, slide 5 at the top of page 3, where it talks about required documentation about original documents. That one of the requirements in the rule is that DHS is required to view the original document. We cannot accept a copy of the original. And in recognizing that that could present a number of difficulties for people, understanding that many people would not want to part with their original documents, such as mailing them into the office, for example. Mm-hmm. What we try to do is provide the applicants with as many options as possible to be able to get those original documents to us. So although they do have the option to mail them if they choose, and some people have chosen to do that, we have also emphasized that they have the option that they could go to any DHS office in the state and present their original documents, and the staff there would then be responsible to view those documents and make copies for our records and also provide some tracking of that and then make sure that those documents get to the correct field office. An example of that would be, let's say an applicant lives in LeGrand, and their case is carried by our statewide OHP Central Processing Branch. They could go to their LeGrand office and present their original documents, and then the LeGrand office would then mail those documents to the statewide processing center. And that makes it quite a bit easier for the applicant as opposed to having to mail those documents to the statewide processing center. Another thing that we have worked extensively with are the outreach facilities that are contracted with DHS, and we have set up a process where applicants can, when they're bringing in their other paperwork and working with those outreach facilities, they can also bring their original citizenship documents, and the staff of the outreach facility will also make the copies, and they have some paperwork they complete for us that they submit along with the copies. And that's all supported in the contract that we have with those outreach facilities.
Are any of these outreach facilities organizations that are actually advocates for benefits for illegal aliens? I mean, I don't know how else to say it, but there's a group of people out there that are very active in trying to assure that there are benefits for those that currently are not allowed to have them under law. So do we have a case where any of these organizations are actually the fox guarding the chicken coop?
Chair Richardson, not that I'm aware of. I don't know if Clyde can answer
that. Chair Richardson, not that I'm aware of. I think the kinds of places we're talking about are food banks and some other types of organizations, community organizations like that. I'm not aware of any outreach facilities who are performing this function who are the types of organizations you're referring to.
Okay. Would you provide me with a list of all the outreach organizations?
Sure.
Okay. Thank you.
On the next slide, also on page 3, slide 6, what the rule also outlines is that we must provide applicants or recipients that are reapplying, we must provide them with what they refer to as a reasonable opportunity period. And that time period that we have chosen to use is a 45-day time period that is consistent with our current practices. It is also consistent with the Code of Federal Regulations that is quoted in the Deficit Reduction Act rule. That 45-day time period can be extended, though, if the applicant has some extenuating circumstances that where they have been attempting to get the documents, but for some reason outside of their control, they have been unable to get them. For example, if they have submitted the paperwork requesting a birth certificate from California, we know that California has a huge backlog and it's taking quite a long time, much lengthier than 45 days to get the documents. Mm-hmm. Then we can give them some additional time to get those documents.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Flores.
Ms. House, when you're talking about the original documents, if you're requesting it at this point in time of, for instance, your example, California, isn't that then a state-certified copy rather than the original document?
Chair Richardson and Representative Flores, yes, an original document, or I actually didn't mention it, but it is in the slide.
That is an or.
It is considered that would be considered a certified copy from the issuing agency. So an original, if you had your original birth certificate, for example, or if you needed to request one from another state.
So it is or.
Yes.
Thank you.
Yes. See, on page 4, slide 7, also, part of this is that DHS is required to provide assistance to applicants, and we can do that in a variety of ways. For example, each state has their own requirements for requesting a birth certificate. So we work with our applicants. We can give them the information as to what paperwork they need to complete, and maybe possibly even help them work through that paperwork so that they can request the documents. Another way that we are assisting them is if they have a circumstance where they have no resources to be able to purchase documents from another state, for example, such as a birth certificate, then we will work with them, if they have no other resources and they just are unable to be able to purchase those on their own, that we have paid for some of those items, such as a birth certificate or possibly identification from the Department of Motor Vehicles.
Karen, in kind of consideration of time, basically the requirements of the federal government are being met. There's a plan and an effort to meet the needs of individuals to help them comply. Yeah. And if you could conclude by just telling us, are there obstacles or burdens that you have are still facing, complaints that you're having to deal with, things that we ought to be aware of?
Chair Richardson, yes, this has been very challenging, and as was mentioned earlier, such as there's lots of questions as to what documents really should be acceptable. For example, we're trying to work with the tribes as far as their tribal membership cards. Right now, those cards are not considered acceptable proof of citizenship. They're only considered identification. And so we are trying to work through some of those kinds of issues. We're finding where there are people that are naturalized citizens, but they do not have their documents, and that can be very costly to get, to be able to get those copies. So there are definitely many challenges. Our requirement is that also, when they submit these, it should just be a one-time only submission, and then we're also working on trying to get all of this information tracked in our system. We're using we've created some new fields in our database so that we can track all that information, so that when they come in and reapply 6 months from now or whenever, we will already have that documentation and they will not need to present it again.
Are you doing that by scanning the document or by just noting that it had been seen at some time by some person?
Chair Richardson, we are We have one office that does have scanning capabilities, and so yes, they are scanning the documents. But in the other offices, in our database, we have information where we can record the type of document that we received, and then we also make a copy of it and keep that in our files. And we also narrate it on our narration system.
In one office, or in all offices?
Chair Richardson, all offices. All offices are doing the making the copies, coding our database, and narrating. We do have one office that does have imaging capabilities that's also imaging.
I see. So the other offices are making hard copies, putting them in a file. You have one that's actually doing digital copies.
Yes.
And is there a movement in your budgeting process to provide scanning capabilities, since this is going to be an ongoing issue and more paper is not preferable?
Chair Richardson, as part of our MMIS medical Medicaid management information system project, there's a electronic document management imaging component to that. And we're also exploring ways to increase the capacity, that imaging capacity, to include other program areas. So we will be using that technology, that capability, to help us meet this requirement as we go live with the new system.
Okay, great. Other questions on this presentation? Thank you very much for bringing us up to date. We now have the update on the Oregon State Hospital, Phase 2. Bob Nickel.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. For the record,
May I interrupt just for a second? Karen, would you mind assuring that list of all outreach providers that are certified be sent by electronic means to all the members of our committee? Thank you. Excuse me.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bob Nickel, and I'm the Assistant Director for the Addictions and Mental Health Division, our new name since we may have talked last. Thank you for the opportunity to give an update on where we are with the Phase 2 process, as we call it, of the State Hospital Master Plan. The overall good news is we're very much on schedule and on target, in my opinion, with all of the timelines that we have committed to. I'll give you a little bit of background and then talk a little bit, and then hopefully if there are questions I can answer them. The background, as you probably remember, is that in November 2004, due to a number of media reports and other issues, the State Emergency Board approved funding so that we get a kind of a head start on a potential plan for a new state hospital. The E-Board authorized us to produce what we now call the Framework Master Plan Phase 1 report, and it was primarily a look at the physical plant of Oregon State Hospital, and it concluded with no great surprise that the buildings were outdated. They were no longer suitable for state-of-the-art contemporary treatment, that some of them were so far deteriorated that there were major concerns about their structural integrity, et cetera. That report was released in May of 2005. During the session, our budget was approved so that we could continue the process. And the Phase 2 report took a more comprehensive look at the entire state hospital and community system and recommended, as you probably are aware, that we move toward three different options. One was to build a 980-bed state hospital. Option two was to build a 620-bed hospital in the Salem-Portland area and a 360-bed state hospital south of Linn County. And then to continue some improvements in the eastern Oregon, central Oregon area. Option three was to build a 60-bed state hospital, I believe, in central Oregon, and then relatively similar-sized state hospitals as the option two provided in the Salem area and again south of Linn County. That report has become the basis for considerable legislative discussion, and an agreement was reached between the governor and the Speaker of the House and the Senate President to move toward option two, which again would be to develop a 620-bed hospital in the Salem-Portland area, 360-bed hospital south of Linn County, and as I mentioned before, some continued improvements in central and eastern Oregon. The phase two report, though, really did not just focus on the need to replace state hospitals. It also looked at the entire system and recommended very strongly that unless we develop stronger what we now call front-end and back-end services and strengthen the entire community mental health system, that we would likely need to build an even larger state hospital and often continue with some of the same kinds of overcrowding and understaffing issues that we've been dealing with for, frankly, many years at the state hospital. The next step was to develop an Oregon State Hospital Site Selection Criteria Committee. I'm trying to recall if any of the members of this committee were on that. Chair Richardson, I think you were probably not on that, but I know you were following it with great interest. That group convened. There were four senators, four representatives, and Lindsey Ball, who is the administrator for the Department of Administrative Services, and Dr. Bruce Goldberg, the director for the Department of Human Services. Dr. Goldberg ran a very tight ship. The group developed its criteria right on schedule. That was issued on August 29th, 2006, a couple of days before the deadline that we'd set for September 1st. From there, we've gone on to work with the Department of Administrative Services. They issued what they call a hot sheet, which was essentially a recruitment to see if there were lands available that might be of suitable size so that we could begin to look at actual specific sites. Out of that process, they received six sites, three of which are state-owned, three of which are privately owned in the Salem-Portland area, and they received a total of 11 sites in the southern Oregon area. Eight of those are private sites, one is a city-owned site, and two of those are state-owned sites. I don't have the particulars on those at this point. The Department of Administrative Services obviously probably takes the lead in terms of looking at land and the acquisition of lands. We'll work and are working closely with them to make sure that program issues get integrated into the review that's currently started to analyze those 17 different sites and to take a look at what they would begin to recommend in the early part of the legislative session in 2007. They, I understand, have just issued a request for proposals to get some additional technical assistance to look at the actual physical locations of the sites to make sure that we don't get too far down the road and then find that we have a site that's, you know, smack in the middle of a riparian zone that would be too costly and too unstable to develop a hospital site. The date for completion of the full site review process for these different sites is to be February 15th, 2007 or sooner, and upon completion of this process, a list of qualified sites would go to the governor, who then would work with the legislature for prior selection, hopefully early in the session. We also have begun to hire staff. The Department of Administrative Services has already established, with legislative permission, of course, a manager position who's been hired and started in November, and then they're moving ahead with a contract and procurement specialist position. And I'm not sure if that position has actually come on board or not, but if not, it will be on board soon. The Department of Human Services...
Just for a moment, you said that there has been a hiring. Is this a project manager who will oversee this project through conclusion?
Mr. Chair, that's correct. The person's name is Ed Wales, and he's the Department of Administrative Services. At the level of the position is Principal Executive Manager E. Mr. Wales has been with the Department of Administrative Services for some time and was instrumental in several other siting and building projects, so he comes with a great deal of experience. The department is in the process of hiring several positions that we were also approved for. The first of these is a full-time fiscal analyst, and that person started in October. And we also are recruiting for a part-time project manager who will help us from our end interface on this very major project with the Department of Administrative Services. We've been looking at some additional systems issues, and I'll just mention those because I think they're very reasonable questions that we'll talk tomorrow a little bit more at the Emergency Board Subcommittee about. But we've recognized that we need to improve our ability to have physicians who are fully qualified and on board. We've run as many as 8 and 9 physician vacancies, and that's something that we've reported on before other legislative bodies. We recently signed a contract with Oregon Health and Sciences University on something that we'd been talking about for some time, which was to move the state hospital into closer proximity with our key medical school in the Department of Psychiatry. So we now have a contract for a chief psychiatrist who started 2 weeks ago, Dr. John Bischoff. He's providing a great deal of assistance already to Dr. Marvin Fickle, who is the chief medical officer, but for whom all of the things related to building a new state hospital, the federal civil rights review, in addition to just running a large state institution, it's going to be very helpful to Dr. Fickle to have a chief psychiatrist who will have additional time to work with physicians to help with recruitment, etc. We are also, we just announced the hiring of Dr. Joseph Bloom, the former dean of the School of Medicine in Portland. He's also a former chair of the Department of Psychiatry. He's semi-retired, but we've gotten his services now 2 days a week, and he started to work with me as a special assistant and also with Dr. Goldberg as a special assistant on mental health issues. So we're really pleased to have Dr. Bloom available. And finally, we've just also signed a contract that will eventually bring as many as 6 psychiatrists to work in the state hospital. 80% of their time will be seeing patients directly. 20% of their time will also be with the state hospital, but doing community consultation, teaching, research, and consultation. And we will begin to fill those positions as we work with the Department of Psychiatry. That will help a great deal towards beefing up the physician services at the Oregon State Hospital.
Are they hired directly, or are they hired through OHSU?
Mr. Chair, they're hired as OHSU employees, so that gives them faculty status. It also gives them some opportunity to do some teaching and research. But they're primarily going to be focusing, as I said, 80% of the time on direct patient care. And the other 20% time is not going to be spent up at the Hill. It's going to be spent working on projects that are directly related to the Oregon State Hospital and improvement in care there. So I'm very pleased, frankly, to be able to develop this kind of relationship with Oregon Health and Sciences University. I think it's something that we've talked about for some time, and it's finally coming to fruition.
I can add to the committee that I've been in communication with Dr. Knight Richardson at OHSU, who will be working closely and kind of overseeing this relationship, and they're very excited about it. They're looking forward to it. It will truly be good for both OHSU and for the state.
Yeah. Thank you. We're very excited about it, too. I think the other set of issues that are probably of most concern that we're beginning to work on are the future workforce preparing the development of enough nurses, doctors, and other staff to get to the staffing levels that will be needed in the next 5 to 10 years as we develop new state hospital buildings, hopefully. We also need to be prepared to have the staff to operate them and provide them. So one of the things that we did was start a what I've called a psychiatric nurse workforce development team. We have representatives from the ONA, from the Center for Nursing, from the unions, from the state hospital, and from most of the nursing programs around the state. And that's actually a very exciting group to be working with. I think there's a lot of interest in how the nurse training programs can help us be prepared for the need for additional nurses in the future. So I'm pleased to report on those developments. And I think with that, I'll stop and see if there are questions. I think I've provided the basics.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Where's the what?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Nickel, earlier this morning we heard about allowable activities that are intended to reduce barriers to people's long-term employment under the TANF program. And one of those allowable activities that we heard about was 4 to 6 weeks of drug and alcohol treatment. And as Deputy Director of Addiction Services, is it reasonable to assume that 4 to 6 weeks of drug and alcohol treatment would significantly reduce the average dependency on those drugs?
Mr. Chair, Representative Witt, I think 4 to 6 weeks is time to begin getting people engaged in treatment, but I don't think there are very many people who would say that a chronic disease like alcohol and drug addictions is really manageable in that short a period of time. I don't want to discount the desire and the impulse to get people started in treatment. I think that's a very good thing, and I applaud that. But if you ask me as an addictions specialist, I think 4 to 6 weeks is enough time to start getting somebody engaged. But it would probably be like asking whether diabetes can be cured in 4 to 6 weeks. You can get people stabilized. That's important, but it's a first step.
Thank you.
Further questions? Thank you very much. Appreciate the update and the timelines.
Could I make a quick comment
Certainly.
On the last
Absolutely.
Question? I appreciate Representative Witt's question. I think it's right on. In my field, we used to consider 25 weeks to be the minimum short-term treatment for these kinds of problems with follow-up.
Is that inpatient?
That was outpatient, and these were for people with relatively minor levels of difficulties. Short-term treatment used to be considered a year, and I'm not. I'm talking about within the last 25 years or so. The degrading of mental health and addiction treatment in the United States is quite appalling, and the idea that federal regulations would actually mandate no more than 4 to 6 weeks is utter nonsense. And I really appreciate the question from Representative Witt and the answer, because I agree very much with both of the point of it.
Just by way of clarification, that discussion was about TANF and what activities would be allowable to be credited toward the employment percentage requirement.
Yes.
And so when they, and I think it was, didn't they go up to 12 weeks because of our high percentage of food stamps in Oregon, but whether it's 4 to 6 or 12 weeks, that focus was not on a limitation for treatment, but it was how long will you be able to have treatment be applied toward the requirements that they have for trying to find a job. And the idea, my understanding, was that if there's going to be intensive treatment, such as inpatient, that you would do it during that period of time. And then after that period of time, if you're going to have meetings and so forth, that's done on your own time. The requirements for employment with TANF, whether it be 20 hours a week or 30 hours a week, we're talking about 5 or 6 hours a day of actual work or activities that would be approved. And then you've got your sleep, and you've got another 10 or 12 hours that you can use doing other things. And so the idea from the federal regulators, in all fairness to them, was that you can do these items fine, but do them on your other time, not the 5 or 6 hours a day that you're supposed to be working to qualify. It wasn't saying that you're going to be limited for treatment, expect to be well by then.
Right.
So anyway, it was a TANF technicality that was being discussed there with that time period.
Thank you. I appreciate the clarification, Mr. Chair. If I may, though, the point of my comment really is that in the context that you raised, it really is that these TANF expectations, especially when they apply a 90% compliance requirement, are quite unrealistic. And I think that was the gist of the testimony we heard. And I, from a professional point of view, I completely agree with that. There certainly are some people who will be able to meet those requirements. I think they said 17%. That sounds about right, but that means that 83% can't.
Okay, what the 17% is what Oregon presently has as a percentage of people that are working. In some states, it's as high as like 53%.
Mm-hmm.
The federal government wants 50% or better and there was like three states at least 6 months ago that were actually able to comply, and the rest were not in compliance. And the TANF program, what the federal government is saying is that this is intended to be funded as a temporary stopgap to help families that can work get to work again, and not intended to deal with the many, many people with barriers that really prevent them from having that kind of work. And yet we don't have a lot of alternative programs to help with those, and that's really what DHS is having to face is, if TANF is going to be what it was intended to be, then what do we do about all these other problems? Right. And we don't have the funding to deal with it. And so that's right. The conflict that they're having.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, I was not intending to criticize the DHS for their response to this problem, but I do believe that the federal requirements are unrealistic, and that people can be brought along to work, but in a more gradual way than the regulations currently require. Another issue, which I think you raised just now, is that has to do with the stage that the states are at in dealing with their populations. I think you quite accurately pointed out early in that testimony, and so did the witnesses, about Oregon's work toward moving people in the TANF population to employment. As the base year was changed, the good progress that we've made is no longer being given credit. I don't know what the situation is in the three states you mentioned, but it wouldn't surprise me to discover that those states are behind us in moving people out of this population into work. And if that's the case, then the differences in percentages are simply artifacts of the date the federal government chooses to apply as the base date for their calculations.
Also, never underestimate a state's ability to game a system.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's another point.
Thank you. There are requirements that are implemented, and then there is considerable effort on how do we deal with these requirements with the realities of what we're confronted.
And I hope we're not doing that, gaming the system.
Our next item.
Disagree on that. I hope we are.
DHS is focusing on what must be done to comply with federal requirements and to assist in making progress with their populations. It's 10:30. We would like to move to update on sensitive case review proposed legislative concepts with Ramona Foley and Bill Taylor. Good morning.
Good morning, Chair Richardson and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Ramona Foley. I'm an assistant director at the Department of Human Services over the area called Children, Adults, and Families. And I was asked to come this morning, and I'm joined by Mr. Taylor.
Bill Taylor, Council Judiciary Committee.
Thank you for being here.
And I wanted to just sort of refresh folks' memories about a sensitive review case that we had this past year, and we are fortunate that two of the members of this committee actually served on that. Both Chair Richardson and Representative Flores were members of that sensitive review. This committee was convened by Director Bruce Goldberg after he had been at the agency a short period of time, maybe a couple of months. And we had permission to do this under an Oregon statute regarding the confidentiality of child welfare records. And that particular statute allows the Director of Human Services to convene a committee, and then with two charges to the committee, actually. One charge is to determine whether or not the department acted appropriately, and two, to make recommendations to the department regarding policy and practice. And I think we were successful in achieving both of those, as well as achieving several other goals as we went through that process. So I want to open my comments by saying that I know it took a lot of time on the part of the four legislators. We were joined by Representative Schaffler as well as Representative Krieger. It took a lot of time, investment of time, but I think what came out of that review was, while it was alarming in terms of looking at state-of-the-art practice, it was also, though, rewarding for us to be able to take what we found and start moving forward in a number of ways. And certainly from the perspective of the Department of Human Services, we've made quite a few changes given what we found in that committee. One of the changes that Director Goldberg is really adamant about, he said, I'd like to see us do this process at least quarterly. He said, we learned so much from this. And even though it was a case that from the outset, our local office thought they were going to look very good in this case because they felt very good about the practice in the case, which was interesting in itself because as we started going deeper into the case, there were things that we all on that committee were alarmed by and didn't see as best practice. So that was a learning, that was a tool in and of itself in terms of how we could work with our managers and our staff in the field to improve practice. But we are going about setting up a process where we will be able to do a case such as this case each quarter, and one of the cases that we have in mind perhaps for the next case is one that we did hear testimony at the hearing on September the 29th. There was a whole day of testimony from individuals concerned about practice in child welfare in their various cases. These were constituents, and one of those cases in particular came across to us as something that really would warrant us being able to learn something from that particular case and how the case was handled.
I might mention, the paperwork alone was 312 pages at one point. I don't know how many total, but
that was the redacted amount.
That was, yes. That's correct. And so it's taking a case where there's a lot of controversy and then going through the whole thing, piece by piece, page by page, and then getting together and discussing the key issues and determining what went wrong, because there's obviously some problems when the agency says we're doing it fine and these people are getting what they deserve, and the people are saying, what has gone on? The government is fouling up our lives. And so it really did review a lot of interesting information about the perspectives that people have, and then it, in the course of that, it revealed processes and procedures that really are not functioning correctly, and so it's led to changes which are going to be beneficial for the whole system.
Yes, Chair Richardson. And some of the things that it did lead to, specifically for us, the original allegation on the case had to do with a concern that maybe a caseworker had removed a child and placed the child with the caseworker's sister, which made us believe we could potentially have a conflict of interest. As we began reviewing, and it was over 1,000 pages, the case record was over 1,000 pages. Joe O'Leary, I give credit for going through that very diligently and pulling out the 310 pages that we then reviewed as being the key documents. It turned out that that particular concern was not a valid concern. There was not a sister relationship. But we also started unfolding other kinds of concerns in terms of general relationships and conflict of interest potential. Folks who are on staff in the agency who may have relationships, personal relationships, with folks who might be vendors in the community. And we began to examine this issue statewide based on what we were looking at in that particular case. That has led us to a significant change, I think, in how we are going to handle conflict of interest within the department. The department has a revised policy agency-wide, but then CAF, Children, Adults, and Families, more specifically, we've taken a position which actually follows national standard from Child Welfare League of America that we're not going to allow our employees to become foster parents or adoptive parents or respite care providers for children who are in DHS custody. There's an exception process to that. The exception is if it is your relative who comes into care, then you certainly should not be deprived of the opportunity of providing a home for your relative. But in that case, you will go through an official process that will receive an exception. The case would be case managed out of a different office. You would be certified by a different office. And then we've created a database in our human resources department so that those are monitored consistently and the conflict of interest cases are kept in one place. So we never have to pause and think about, did somebody think they have a conflict of interest or not have one? The other exception would be where you had a significant relationship previously with the child. For example, your best friend's child comes into care and you've been neighbors for 20 years, that kind of thing. But it will be looked at individually And it will be looked at both by the CAF management, but also by HR management, to make sure that it passes what we believe would be an exception for a conflict of interest. That is going into effect this month, this next month in December, and we're training statewide on that. And we have done quite a bit of work with our labor management team to make sure that staff really understand this is not a penalty for folks who really want to donate time. Staff are still entitled to be a foster parent with a private organization. They could adopt through a private agency, those kinds of things. But it really is around the perception that we had that grew out of the sensitive review case, and that is, if you are a parent whose child has been taken into care by a caseworker and you go into that office and the person sitting at the next desk happens to have your children in care, what is that public perception, and how? What is the fairness, and what does it feel like to that individual family? So several of you have also been very good about sharing those kinds of constituent issues, and we very much appreciate that. But I think it's taken us to a much better place in terms of that policy. Bill, did you want to? Because I can go on and talk some more about the DHS, the kinds of changes we're doing, but also don't want to not give you an opportunity to talk about some of the broader things outside of
the DHS. Whenever time you'd like me to discuss what the different work groups are doing, I'd be glad to do so. I can wait until...
Okay, we have a half hour, so if you want to just take another minute or two.
I will do that. As we said, we reviewed an extensive file. Some of the issues that came out for DHS is that we had some rules that are in conflict with each other. For example, Chair Richardson found one almost immediately where we had two different rules relating to relative placements, and one rule said you must give consideration to relatives, and another said you must give preference to relatives. As we began unfolding this and trying to align these two rules, we also find we have another rule that feeds into this, and this is the rule around current caretaker. And that is a foster parent who has had a child in their home for a significant period of time, and then how do you weigh the psychological bonding to the foster parent if the relative is not found or doesn't come forward till later. We're working on that, and we've involved our Child Welfare Advisory Committee to help us come out with what is the best and the most consistent rule that we need to have around this practice. But it is a very crucial practice for us in that we continue to want to have children placed with relatives, if at all possible, when they come into care. And about 30% of children in foster care in our state are living with relatives. But those kinds of decisions and having to be made in a very emotional period of time are really critical in terms of what happens ultimately in a case. Too many caseworkers handling a case. That was something we saw in this case, and we puzzled over how did the decisions get made as to when the case got changed. And this is one that we want to have a model that dictates, basically, prescribes when can a caseworker change from a case. There's always going to be issues around attrition. People leave. People change jobs. But we don't want to have just the arbitrary assigning of a case from one worker to the other, because we know what happens in that experience is the case loses time. You lose the value of the relationship with both the client, with the child, and with the child's family. Every time you change workers, it slows down the progress toward either getting the child back home or getting the child into an adoptive placement. And we are anticipating a study from National Resource Center on Organizational Improvement. They have been involved with us since about May, and that study should be out this month. And we ask them to help us look at how do we make decisions around assigning staff, and is there a best practice model that we should be using, and then making that the model we use across the state so that we don't pick up a case and see three or four different caseworkers' names involved in a fairly short period of time. I've already talked about the conflict of interest and what I think that takes us to a different place. We are also bringing into place a new model for child protective safety. You will recall from the Holder report on the National Resource Center on Child Protective Services, we have been working diligently, and we have rolled out the conceptual training for 2,000 of our staff over the last 2.5 months. We have 400 pages of either new or revised regulations, and we were hoping to have those all commented on in November. That was unrealistic on our part, I think, in retrospect. 400 pages is a lot of new rules, and some of those are cleanup rules that we found where we had inconsistency in old rules. It may have been promulgated at different times. And so we have delayed the review process on that until January 31st. But we still plan to have an implementation date for the new child safety model based on the national best practice model. Oregon's model looks slightly different because we have different statutes and we have different rules. But it's going to be, I think, a much tighter model, much more prescribed in terms of when do we open a case, when do we close a case, how do we make sure that workers have considered relatives prior to putting the child into a foster home that's not a relative, and there will be an accompanying procedure manual with that. And that procedure manual will, for the first time, prescribe to the worker, here are the steps you must take when you become involved in a child welfare case, whether it's the CPS hotline call that comes in, the assessment. We want to drive towards more precision and more consistency in how we're doing child welfare work, and I think that's going to move us to a much better place. Again, the implementation date for that is March the 20th, so we'll keep you apprised as we move forward.
Okay, thank you. I think it's vitally important that you have these kinds of protocols in place to not only appropriately start cases, but also assure that they don't linger. I mean, in the past, there's been a problem with when do you terminate a case, because every case that's open has to be reviewed periodically and all those things, and so to have determinations when it's no longer necessary to keep the file open allows for better utilization of your caseworkers.
Yes, we agree, Chair.
And restores the families.
Yes.
You know, they're in a lot of stress.
Okay.
Mr. Taylor.
Yes.
Proposed litigation. Proposed legislation.
Excuse me.
It's a proposed legislation.
Proposed legislation. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bill Taylor. I'm with the Judiciary Committee, and I believe you have a list of proposed drafts. I can't really give you copies of these yet because they're still a work in progress. What has happened, I took over this issue from Joe O'Leary when he decided to pursue other opportunities. I can tell you his new office is not as nice as his old office. But you have before you, I listed 10 bills. These are issues that have come from this work group after you completed your work with the Sensitive Review Committee. Representative Krieger had discussions with Senator Brown, and they have formed a work group similar to what we did in the meth package from the last session. It includes Representative Krieger, Senator Brown, Senator Cruz, and Representative Schaffler. They had been meeting periodically. We'll meet again this month for the purposes of going over the Sensitive Review Committee, talking to Ramona Foley and other people. We will be meeting with judges at our next meeting to discuss from their viewpoint issues that they see. And we have a list of drafts, I said, that are still a work in progress. You see one, LC 303, limits DH rights to petition file to terminate parental rights. This is mainly an issue when the courts and DHS may be at odds. It's a rough draft that I sent to Legislative Counsel's office. It's not back yet. In defense of Legislative Counsel's office, not that they need defense, they are required by statute to work on agency drafts now. And they are just finishing up on those and now are getting to the drafts that we have from either the Judiciary Committee or this work group. LC 304 requires local citizens review board to conduct review within 6 months. LC 305 authorizes court to give preference to placement of child with a relative. That has been an issue, I believe, in the sensitive review process that you're involved in, and has been an issue raised by different members from time to time because of constituent issues.
What does it mean that the court would be authorized to do that which is already in statute as a preference? Presently, the court doesn't have the ability?
Mr. Chairman, it was the committee. Sometimes those issues and sometimes statutes are ambiguous, and sometimes one needs to clarify those issues.
So this is saying that a circuit court judge will be authorized to do something which is already supposedly a requirement within DHS?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, sometimes it's just better to put those things in statute. It's a policy decision, but...
Okay.
Mr. Taylor, thank you, Mr. Chair. Why wasn't, direct the court to give preference? Was that discussed in the work group? I mean, you're authorizing... I agree with the chair.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wilson, I'm an attorney, and these people are my clients. It's hard for me to discuss what they said or did not say in the work group. So I would, if
he's
you
going
don't
to
mind,
pretty client privilege. Yeah, okay.
Well, I think I'm not be sure best if you have the opportunity to discuss directly with them individually or collectively
that particular issue.
That's fine. Ms. Foley?
Yeah. Chair Richardson, I was just going to say, as a practice issue, the court does look at what the plan is to be, whether it's going to be return home, whether it's going to be adoption, whether it's going to be permanent foster care. And as I recall, because I'm not part of that particular work group, but as I recall, what we were seeking was an opportunity for the court to actually look at this issue and say, I think, DHS, you need to be looking at that relative. Have you looked at that relative closely? It's more or less, it kind of reaffirms for the court to have the authority to make sure we are doing that. It's not that we shouldn't be doing that in practice, and in rule we should be doing that. But as I recall, it was another option to reinforce how important this particular issue is, especially when the case gets started.
Okay. And the purpose of doing this, by the way, just for us to be informed as to some of the things that they're looking at and...
Sure.
Yeah. So we'll try not to grill you because I understand you're the messenger. So, but
no problem.
Go forward.
Let me see. LC 306, police officer present when taking child. It's an issue that the agency feels strongly about, and I also understand that some of the advocacy groups feel strongly the other way. So, it will be an issue when, if and when, before the legislature will be debated.
Again, I'd like to turn to Representative Ms. Foley. The issue, I recall, is that there are times when a caseworker is placed in a very difficult position. Maybe she's a person's young, inexperienced, and now the decision is going to be, I'm going to pull this child or these children away from the parents, and it's caused a repeated problem for us when we get calls from families saying, they just came and took my kids. And so the idea was maybe there should be someone else involved in making that decision. Is that what we're addressing here? And has there been a determination that it's going to be a police officer?
Chair Richardson, that is what we're addressing. It's called what we refer to as the worker authority to remove, because the statute does allow the caseworker to make that decision. I think the feedback we've had from the advocates, there is concern that if you had to wait for a law enforcement officer to be present, which in best practice is what happens, and it happens a lot now, but if you were in a location where you had to wait for an officer to be present and a child is in immediate danger, we don't want to thwart the opportunity of having the child be safe. And it may be that the worker is the only one present. What we're working on with law enforcement now, even though this is one of our major concepts, is could we work something through administratively where we do cross-training with law enforcement and with our child welfare staff, where we also put in some safeguards like a child can't be removed by a caseworker without the caseworker consulting with their supervisor prior to that happening. So those are some of the administrative issues that we've been asked to look at, and we're very glad to look at that because it may be that the statute itself, as this goes forward and people have more discussion around it, it may be that the problem is not in the statute. It may just be in terms of the practice itself. We want to make sure families have due process. We want to make sure that the worker doesn't have the burden of making the decision around removal. But we realize that the role of the law enforcement officer is different than the role of the child protective service worker. And law enforcement doesn't want to have to be the only one there also to make that decision, though they can under the law if a child, again, is in danger.
Okay, well, thank you for bringing that up, and certainly these will all be, you know, either considered if they make it, you know, they'll go to committee and be vetted. The chances of a police officer telling a caseworker, no, I don't think the child should be taken out of the home after a caseworker has made that decision is a little bit slim, so it may not be, if the goal is to assure that there's a second set of eyes, that may not solve the issue by merely putting that requirement. But that can be vetted during the course of the session.
Chair, members of the committee, next one is LC 1195, Codify Sensitive Review Committees. Ms. Foley stated a little bit earlier, sensitive review is only mentioned among the records provisions as an exemption to the otherwise confidential records. This would codify the process and procedure. It also gets into another interesting issue. One of the inherent powers of the legislature is oversight. Practically all the records involved here are confidential because of the sensitive nature of them, particularly as they relate to the child and family. What we have tried to do here is allow for greater involvement of the legislature in requesting or asking for, and I want to use the term asking for as opposed to request, that DHS have a sensitive review committee on a particular issue. once you get involved in this issue are constitutional questions of separation of powers, in the sense that you cannot have the legislature demanding that the head of the agency carry out an executive function. That's what I've been told. It's not unusual when we have, for example, when we create boards, sometimes we have to make them advisory when we have members of the judicial, legislative, and executive branch involved. So that's the fine course that we have to walk on this particular issue. You have the sensitive nature of the records versus the legislature's inherent power to have oversight, and at the same time a need for oversight here, and this is what we're trying to address by codifying a process and procedure that would allow greater oversight between those different forces out there. The next one is LC 1202, Bill to Increase Funding for Legal Representation of Families. One of the things that came out in the sensitive review that you were involved in, the two you're involved in, is that the state spent $130,000 on legal fees. The families involved had a little over $5,000. The council, the Court of Appeals, was obviously very good because the family won in the Court of Appeals as you were going through this process. Slightly after you finished, the Court of Appeals overturned the case and sent it back, I believe, to the agency or circuit court, one or the other. But that's one. The other thing that we have, there was a study done up in the state of Washington where they substantially increased funding and the quality of lawyers involved in one particular county, two counties. At the same time, they had funding to do an empirical study on what the results were. And what they found out is that when they had attorneys who knew what they were doing and had time to do what they do, the child spent substantially less time in foster care, and the child was more likely than in the past to be returned to the family, which research shows is also, if it can be done, is the best result. So what it showed is that with an investment upfront in legal representation, the state and the system would save money, and the child would be better off. They've got about a 25-page study. I'd be glad to give a copy of that to the committee administrator if you'd like a copy of it, if you don't already have it.
Yes.
LC 1203 requires DHS to report foster care child abuse, in this case to CASR or to the attorney. LC 1204 requires DHS to submit biennially report to the legislature relating to children in foster care and abuse. LC 1237 encourages siblings to be placed in the same home. So if you had a brother or sister a year apart, there'd be encouragement that they'd be kept together. And I think research shows that that's a preferable way of placing kids. And then finally, LC 1477 creates an ombudsman for DHS and dependency matters. Chair, members of the committee, I'd be glad to take any questions.
Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Of course, Mr. Taylor can't answer because of potential. Maybe Mrs. Foley could, too. In your, seriously, Mr. Taylor, the committee, did you look at preference to two-parent families versus single-parent families? Is that, or do we need to address that, Mrs. Foley? Has that been an issue, or is that in statute now?
Mr. Chairman of the committee, Representative Wisnett, there is no LC request that I have submitted as it relates to that issue.
Chair Richardson and Representative Wisnett, it's also not a criteria in the rules at this point that a particular family, and I assume you're talking about foster care or adoption.
Yes, ma'am.
Or consideration of a relative, any of those individuals. It's more around whether or not they can provide the care, whether or not they're a safe placement, whether or not they have the ability to parent that child. So we have many foster families who are single parents. We also have many that are families. Married couples, as well as adoptive families, so we don't have a restriction on that at this point.
Are you aware of any research that indicates that a two-parent home is preferable to for a child than a single-parent home?
Chair Richardson, there is some, not related to child welfare necessarily, but there's globally there's some research that looks at parenting. There's also research, though, that looks at whether or not parents who do not have a safe or supportive relationship with each other, whether or not those families are best families for children, or is it better to have at that point a single parent rather than having a very dysfunctional family. So I've heard this argued from really both perspectives, but I think you're right. There is research that says all things being equal, if you actually have a healthy family and you have two adults in that family or couple, you may end up having more support for each other and therefore better outcomes for children. Mm-hmm. Also had to do with financial.
I certainly did not intend to get into a situation where you're looking at a bad couple versus a good single.
But I didn't think you did,
Chair. The question was on foster parents or adoptive parents, where you have the choice of who they are, is there a preference given to having a mother and a father in that home?
Chair Richardson, I'm not aware of research related to foster care and adoption. We can certainly go back and check that, but I'm not aware that there's been any study that shows that the outcomes for children in foster care adoption are one way or the other in terms of outcomes if it's a two-parent family versus a one-parent family.
Yes. Thank you. I want to move on to a slightly different topic, if I may. Thank you. Early on in your testimony, you talked about national standards for best practice. I really have a two-part, and then you indicated also that we had to modify that to some extent because of local statutes, meaning Oregon statutes. Really two questions. The first one is, do the experts in the department believe that the national best practice standards are appropriate, or are there any significant controversy about that? And the second piece of the question is, are there statutes that get in the way of implementing best practices that we ought to be looking at in order to implement best practices?
Chair Richardson and Representative Barnhart, the national standards that we refer to often are Child Welfare League of America and Council on Accreditation. And I don't think our statutes themselves actually present a barrier. I do think we have had some resource issues that present barriers to us as we try to move towards those national standards. I think there are some examples with the national model for child safety where we are not going to be able to say we're embracing 100% of this national model for child safety because of some of the conditions and the resource issues we have here. An example is with the national model for child safety, when a report comes into a hotline, the national standard requires that you have a contact with that child within 24 hours. And we currently have a process where if it is an emergency or if it meets certain criteria, that face-to-face contact has to be within 24 hours. But we also have a second piece to that, that it can be up to 5 days if the perpetrator, the alleged perpetrator, doesn't have access to the child victim. And that's a concession we've made around our staffing as it currently is. We would love to move to a standard where it says within 24 hours every child and family is going to be seen when that call comes in. And that's going to continue to be our goal. But I think we should always keep paying attention, even if we can't meet every national standard. I'm a big believer that those standards are out there for a purpose, and it should present us a goal and something we want to strive towards.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Representative Flores.
Thank you, and I'll make them brief, Mr. Chair. Ms. Foley, in regard to a clarification, in regard to the conflict of interest study, you indicated that was going to be put into effect, did you say December?
Chair Richardson, Representative Flores, it will go, the piece on CAF, Children, Adults, and Families, goes into effect in December. The other policy, the more global DHS conflict of interest policy, is in effect now. It's been issued.
And I was looking at the conflict of interest policy, which is has an effective date of 11/1/06.
That would be the general DHS policy.
And in that, in regard to conflict of interest, maybe I need to take this and have a conversation with you as far as clarification, because I don't see it quite as strong as I'd hoped.
Chair Richardson and Representative Flores, you won't see it in the DHS policy because each of the divisions is going to deal with their issues in a way. For example, there may be similar issues in SPD, Seniors and People with Disabilities, in terms of individuals serving family members and perhaps having a potential conflict with something else, with a vendor. But for children, adults, and families, we have taken the general, the broad policy in the agency, and we have now become more specific. And so the policy I was describing about having to have an exception to be a foster parent applies to children, adults, and families and the employees within that area.
Perfect. Second follow-up, sir?
Representative Flores.
Thank you. And you referenced also the September 29 hearing where there were a considerable number of families who were there to state their concerns about their encounters, I guess, with the Department of Human Services. And then, Mr. Taylor, you mentioned an NLC draft that isn't on the list, but I wrote in Ombudsman for DHS Matters.
That's correct. Mr. Chairman, of the committee, Representative Flores.
And
my apologies for not putting up. It's
LC
1477.
But in regard to that number of families, which was just but a modest representation of the people who really wanted to be there that day, I'm wondering if something other than an ombudsman review would be more appropriate, a special entity controller or what have you, that would be able to have a little bit more authority and force and oversight.
Chair Richardson and Representative Flores, that is certainly something we'd be interested in discussing. Bruce Goldberg is, as you know, a big believer in transparency and in the accountability. And he has actually talked to me about maybe at some point, if we had the resources, having a special unit that would report to him. And I could be part of that conversation, but something that would elevate when you have a concern that requires the kind of work that we would see in a sensitive review, for example, maybe not having to wait till four times a year, but some type of, I hesitate to call it an investigation because that frightens people, but some kind of an assessment, a high-level assessment, similar to what I understand they have in the corrections department, where someone reports directly to Dr. Goldberg, and then we learn from those cases, and there's that level of oversight. The other thing I think, as we have that conversation, we need to keep in mind, though, is the layers of oversight that are there in law and should be used well. And we saw some problems with that when we did the sensitive review. But when you think about it, the CASA program, one of the things that we now have worked with Mickey Lansing on is making sure that if a CASA decides they can't serve on a case, we need to know why that is. We don't want CASAs to be intimidated. The CASA program, the Citizens Review Board, is a safeguard on the system. And ultimately, the court is the safeguard, the ultimate safeguard on a system. So I heard all of those testimonies that day and left there with a number of questions, more questions than answers, in terms of how can we make sure that all of these systems and these pieces that we have in place in statute now that are good, how can we make sure that they all are working so that we have fewer of those kinds of situations that we heard about on the 29th?
And I would insert, Mr. Chair, that those levels, the Citizen Review Board and the CASA and so on, are either not rubber stamping or that they are being able to make independent analyses and not just perpetuating perhaps some misuse of authority by or representation by caseworkers.
And Chair Richardson and Representative Flores, and also not to oversell, the CASA program, I believe, is only in about 30% of our cases in foster care. And in many states, it's in 100% of the cases in foster care. They have that type of court-appointed special advocate.
Okay. Thank you. Just one final question, and that is, when you talk about conflict of interest, I'm aware of cases where caseworkers presently have multiple foster children of their own. Will the provisions that you have discussed be retroactive, or will they only be future?
Chair Richardson, that's a wonderful question. I didn't include that, but it's
his question.
Thank you, Representative Hadson. What we did was we've done a two-part process. We don't want to disrupt the placements of children who might be doing extremely well with an employee who may have had that child in their home for 5 or 6 years. So what we've done is we're going to bring all of those situations. We've head-counted all those situations. We're bringing those all into compliance with this conflict of interest policy. But what we've said is as the policy goes in place in December, we will no longer be putting ourselves in a situation where we have general applicant foster parents who are our employees. So in other words, as those children leave those homes, those children will not be replaced by additional foster children. So we did that in order to protect the best outcome for those particular children.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Taylor. Now we'll move to the review of DHS's proposed legislative initiatives with Dr. Goldberg.
Good morning, members of the committee, Chair Richardson, Bruce Goldberg, Director of the Department of Human Services. We've got a brief time on the agenda to go over this, so I thought at a very high level, what I would just do is provide you with an overview, not just of legislation, but really of the directions, the policy initiatives, the needs that I see from the perspective of the Department of Human Services. So it's really at a high level our both legislative policy budget initiatives. And what you have before you is a handout which really outlines what I believe are the six areas that we need to focus on. Number one is children's health and safety, and you've heard some of that already today when you just heard from Ramona and Bill about some of the certainly policy legislative initiatives to increase children's health and safety. We believe that we need to make some investments in mental health and alcohol and drug treatment, which are really imperative to a lot of issues around children's health and safety. We know that 62% of kids who are in foster care have parents who have substance abuse problems. And we know that we've seen a dramatic decrease. As we've seen substance abuse issues increase in the state, there's been a decrease in the number of parents who are able to get into treatment. Simply put, there's less treatment available. And if we're going to improve children's health and safety, that's an issue that we need to invest in. We think that there are a number of issues around community infrastructure. As we've come off of 5 years of what have been cuts to human services programs, what we've seen is really two things that have happened. As there have been budget cutbacks, the state has been unable to pay providers of community services enough to keep pace with the increasing cost of doing business. And we've never been, I don't think, what anyone would call one of the better payers. And we've certainly fallen even further behind over the last 5 years. And that's clearly been one of the issues that states have faced. When the dollars aren't there, do we put dollars into increasing provider rates? Do we put dollars into covering more people? And I think what's happened in this state over the last several years has been both cuts to services to individuals, witness 100,000 people losing access to the Oregon Health Plan, cuts to alcohol and drug and mental health programs, as well as an inability to keep pace with provider reimbursement, which is really an access problem. So, two issues are really community infrastructure, what we pay our community providers for services. 85% of what we do as a department, we contract out for. We are a large state agency, but when you really look at where our dollars go, I think it's 84.4% are spent contracting for services with community providers, paying doctors and hospitals and nursing homes and those who take care of people with disabilities, and payments to foster parents, and payments to our TANF recipients, which haven't increased in over 10 years. We really need to make some investments in that infrastructure.
Goldberg?
Yeah.
During the last session, we were confronted with a situation involving like caregivers to developmentally disabled, and we have private caregivers and we have state caregivers doing the same work, but the pay that is received by the state workers was substantially higher than those in the private sector, and yet if the private sector refused or for whatever reason collapsed and was unable to provide care to the 2,000 or more patients, they would then become a state responsibility. Will DHS be advocating for a parity in pay for those doing the same kind of work?
Chair Richardson, yes. There's certainly not just parity between what's paid for by state, what's cared for by state providers and what's done in the private sector, but we're also advocating for parity across agencies. We often have agencies that pay for similar services at different rates, which doesn't make a lot of sense. We need to pay fairly, and we need to pay what are the costs of providing the service. And that's really what we need to do. And we'll be advocating for that. It's, quite frankly, it will be, I think, a huge investment on the part of the state to be able to fill the hole that's been created by years of not keeping pace, and as well as also at the same time getting at the next issue, which is restoring not just payments but levels of service, restoring cuts to alcohol and drug programs, mental health services, access to health care, and that's certainly another piece, is not just community infrastructure but then access to services. And a few of the big services that we see as real issues are certainly access to health care. The numbers of individuals without access to health care in this state has increased, and certainly we're working on the Governor's Healthy Kids Initiative, looking at restoring some individuals to OHP standard and looking at ways we can increase access to health care. Mental health care is a huge issue. You heard a report from Bob Nickel earlier, and certainly on several levels. We need to look at what we're doing around, the facilities, the state hospital, which we need to build a new facility, but it really isn't just about building a new facility. It's really about creating a community infrastructure whereby we have front-end services so that we can treat people in the community. We can get access to care when it's needed and not wait until people need high-end tertiary care and need to go to an inpatient setting. And so this really isn't just about a state hospital. It's about being able to make investments in our community mental health systems, in the ability to be certain that those most vulnerable with mental illness get access to the medicines that they need up front so that they don't end up in our hospital. And that's really part of the whole master plan. There's also issues around prevention and preparedness. You know, some of the same issues around infrastructure are needed in our local community health departments where we haven't made investments for numbers of years in our drinking water systems in the state, so we can assure that people have safe drinking water. And that's another infrastructure issue that we need to address as a state. And then the last, and we'll sort of get to that in the last half of part of this meeting, is the infrastructure within the Department of Human Services, that as we've made a commitment to improving our fiscal accountability, that certainly looking at some of the ways we can make investments in the department that in the long run will assure greater accountability, greater efficiency, and greater effectiveness, and a better ability to manage the types of complex needs, payments, patients that exist in the state. And, you know, looking at what we can do in terms of financial recoveries, information systems, and other investments. So those are the themes you're going to, I think, and I hope, hear us focus on. And then, you know, we've got about 40 ledge concepts. You heard about some of them. I don't think we have the time to really go through all of those this morning, but they range from such issues as certainly the governor's healthy kids package. You heard about TANF reauthorization this morning from Mr. Todd. There are, you know, issues around drinking water. We want to take a real careful and good look at our public health laws to assure that we have the appropriate authorities and that there aren't any statutory gaps in how we as a state respond to public health emergencies, some issues around enhancing emergency medical services out in rural areas, a variety of issues. So let me just was trying to give a high-level overview. Let me stop there and see if there are any questions.
Representative Barnhart.
Thank you. Dr. Goldberg, first I want to thank you for your help in working out the kinks of some of the new regulatory systems that you and I worked on earlier this year. I think that was successful, and I appreciate it. The question I have really gets back to the mental health system, and I'd like to know whether you're satisfied at this point that the planning that we need for the community-based mental health system as a piece of the overall system is adequate to allow us to get into the kind of detailed planning that we seem to have reached for the central mental hospital system. And the reason I ask the question is that I'm not sure that the answer to that question is yes, and I'd like your view.
Chair Richardson and Representative Barnhart, I think that we have put a lot of efforts into the planning and conversations around the facility. And I do believe that we need to increase the conversation and the amount of time that we're spending about planning for the community system. I think that we've begun to do that. I think that this effort has been one where we want to move as quickly as possible and be able to capitalize on momentum. At the same time, we don't want the speed with which we move things along to, you know, get in the way of spending some of the time on some of the issues that need the time. And I think we've been trying to balance that. I think we've focused on some of the bricks and mortar issues, primarily because there were some real timelines that needed to get met around being able to identify land, obtain certificates of participation, and some issues that if you don't meet, you can lose a year or 2 years at a time. And I think that we've addressed those things. I think we've got a process and a plan in place. And I believe that now is the time to focus more on community infrastructure, and that we'll be doing that.
Just a follow-up, if I may, on that topic. Thank you. I guess one of the things that occurs to me is that the implications for what services are provided locally, including potentially some short-term inpatient facilities, or shorter-term inpatient facilities on a diffuse basis around the state rather than centrally, may have implications for the size of these central facilities. And I wonder if that issue has been addressed in a clear way.
Chair Richardson and Representative Barnhart, yes, I do believe that we are addressing that when you look at the master plan, it does take into account, I think, a couple of things. One is the fact that currently we don't have enough beds in the state. Two, the need for to contend with our population growth. And to plan out, we can't just build a facility that meets our needs today. We have to be able to build a facilities that will be able to meet our needs over the next 10 and 20 years so that we're not immediately outsized. And then lastly, we need to fit that into a plan that addresses what we're going to do about the community system. And I believe that we're looking at all of those dynamics and looking to build both the number of beds that will pay attention to the growth of the community system as well. We're not building the number of beds to meet the demand based on the current community system. It's really about what do we need to... We really are going down a two-step process. We need to not only develop inpatient beds, but we need to develop more community infrastructure, more abilities to both have people in settings where they can be treated so that they don't need to go into the hospital. One of the reasons, however, that our hospital is currently filled beyond capacity is that we also don't have places to discharge people to. So we are working as quickly as possible, and I believe Bob Nichols shared with you some of the plans about the development of our community placements, which we're working on as quickly as we can.
Because of the time.
That's a very useful answer. I appreciate it.
Great. Is Mr. Scherzinger here?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. If he could join us and we can have an update on the budget and financing procedures.
Yeah, we were going to move into it. I believe you've got now a handout that looks like this, where we're going to go through some of our financial accountability and forecasting improvements. And to provide a high-level overview, I know that Representative Richardson has been very involved with us in a number of committees and oversights for the rest of the members of the committee. I think it's certainly no secret that a year ago the department faced a rather large budget hole, and we've been making some great strides since that time to be able to provide the kind of accountability and assurance that we don't get into a situation like that again. That began by, in November a year ago, my asking the state treasurer and the state controller to come into the department and do a complete overview of our entire financial operations system. And what the state controller and the treasurer did was assemble a team of state experts who spent a couple of months doing what was a rather exhaustive review of the department, looking at our accounting, budgeting, accounts receivable, banking, treasury, our financial information systems. They visited three states known for their human services financial expertise. They visited, I believe, Washington, Arizona, and Michigan. And came up with a rather comprehensive report. And the issue about the report has been this wasn't a report that sits on a shelf. This was really a report that was a work plan, which, because I didn't want a report that made a bunch of recommendations and sat on a shelf, but it really needed to be a blueprint for change. And that's what it was. It was a blueprint for change which set out a number of steps that we needed to do both in the short term and the long term in each of about seven or eight areas, and we'll go over those very briefly, and set out some timelines, some responsibilities, and some ways to do that. We developed those work plans, and we have been meeting regularly, and I believe you have with you a copy of this checklist. We've been meeting monthly with an oversight group comprised of three senators, three representatives, Representative Richardson, Representative Barker, Representative Morgan, Senators Nelson, Johnson, and Senator Carter, and the state controller, Ken Rocco from LFO, John Britton. We've been meeting. We meet on a monthly basis and really review the progress that we've made in achieving the steps in that plan. At a high level, before I let Jim get into some of the details, one of the first things we've done has been to really really change our executive management structure, and I've created two deputy directors. We've created a deputy director that's really a chief financial officer for what is a, you know, we're a $5 billion a year organization, and a deputy director for operations. And you know Clyde Psyche, and have hired Jim as the deputy director for finance, is really a chief financial officer. But more than doing that, the issue has been really aligning all of our financial functions under one individual with responsibility. We had a number of our functions that were spread throughout the organization, accounting in one part, budgeting in another, there not being real coordination and communication between the various fiscal pieces of our agency. And we've changed that structure. We've aligned everything together as a financial services unit, have established, you know, clear lines of, you know, responsibility, command, and control. And, you know, we've really been fortunate to have Jim working with us that in that regard. And what Jim's been doing now has been, you know, overseeing really the, you know, improving our entire fiscal operation. And, you know, at this point, let me turn things over to Jim to just go through, I think, some of the highlights of what we've done to give you a sense of what I believe are the, you know, has been really some dramatic progress in moving us to the place that we need to be.
Hey, Jim Scherzinger, Department of Human Services. I think Bruce said that we had an oversight committee meeting that looked at this list yesterday. The steering committee, which is the first item on here, had their meeting this morning, so this list is already out of date because we've got some updates at that meeting. But still, I think functionally it's still current. So the steering committee meets monthly, and it's moving right along. The working capital committee, and I'll try to hit the highlights of this, so stop me if I'm going too fast or if you have a question about a particular thing. The working capital committee has got much of their work finished. They've made short-term recommendations and even some long-term recommendations that I'm pulling into a report. I guess the bottom line of this is that we have two cash flow issues, the suspense account and the way the cash control on the accounting system works. We have three solutions. One is to improve our processes. The second is to begin to accrue expenditures in sort of the normal way one would do it that our systems don't permit us to do now, but as our systems get better, they were designed more for federal reporting, I think, than for the accounting requirements that the state has. At least the way we're currently using them. And so to begin accruing expenditures when our systems permit us to do that and to build balances in other funds, which is the normal way any state agency would handle its cash flow needs. So those are the three solutions. Another piece of advice they gave us was to look for at least a partial solution in our rebalance process. That is, if we could save some money, that we would ask that money be set aside to handle the cash flow needs at the end of the biennium, which has been the high-profile issue that you have seen from the legislative side. And the recommendation that we've made and will be considered by the E-Board tomorrow in committee is that we will manage our budget to get to produce, I think it's $9.8 million less spending than was set aside in the E-Board allocation, the special allocation, and actually another $10 million from another one. But they set aside at least that $9.8 million to handle the cash flow needs at the end of the biennium. In addition to that, we expect that the in putting the provider tax funded programs on a more of a cash basis, that would solve another $28 million of the cash flow need that comes from revenue, the way we do revenue accruals now.
Let me interrupt just for a second. In our last meeting, we talked about the fact that we can anticipate about a $78 million shortfall
right,
because of the process in the past, which has been to budget as if all the money was going to be coming in, all the revenues needed within a two-year period. But in reality, because of provider tax and tobacco tax and other things, there was some money that didn't come in until after the end of the fiscal year. And so that meant that there'd be a situation where we have to borrow money
right.
at the end of the biennium to cover that shortfall because the bill's due, but the money's not going to come in yet.
Right.
And so I'm just
you're right.
That very appreciative good. Of the yeah. fact that what they're doing to help deal with that is they're conserving money wherever possible so that instead of being a $78 million shortfall, it's going to be $28 million and $10 million less at this point, assuming that caseloads don't change dramatically in the next 6 or 8 months. But the process is analyzing what to went on, what can be done, where savings can be made, and so that we can anticipate this shortfall that's going to happen in the last quarter and lessen it as much as possible, and that's being done.
Right. Mr. Chair, it seems to me that there's another issue, too, that's related directly to that, and that is whether or not there are other funds within the state government which can be borrowed in order to tide us over that hump, or whether we have to actually go out into the financial markets to borrow money in order for the whole state government to be solvent at that transition time. And I know there was a time in the past when, in fact, all of our funding was done internally. And I don't believe that's the case anymore, and it hasn't been for several years.
Well, I believe the state right now has enough cash.
Today, yes.
And I believe that even the loan that we took out last time was from other funds of the state.
That's the kicker.
They charge us interest. They charge DHS interest.
Well, actually, it wasn't from the kicker. It was from other funds. It wasn't from the general fund when they did the loan last time. So I anticipate that to the extent that we need to do that, that it will be a loan from other funds of the state like it was last time. As we have a long way to go between now and the end of the biennium, as we manage the budget, caseloads change, other things might happen. So we're still going to be looking to identify and try to manage our way through as best we can without a loan, but to the extent that we ultimately need it. The current estimate was that if we started with $78 million as the cash flow need that arises because of the way we accrue revenue, that if the nine set aside would help solve that, the $28 million in the way the balances are working on the provider tax, that would leave about $41 million left at the end of the biennium.
Is in your budget request from the to be in a part of the governor's budget, have you dealt with the shortfall so that it gets resolved in the next biennium?
We do not have a specific amount requested in the ongoing budget, in the next time's budget, specifically for cash flow. There is not a package in there specifically for cash flow.
So theoretically, we'll be facing some $40 to $50 million at the end of the next biennium unless something else...
Theoretically, but you also have 2 years to figure out I honestly believe that this is a problem we can solve, given enough time and effort.
Mr. Chair, perhaps a slightly different way of asking the question is this truly a cash flow issue, or is it a deficit issue? And I guess another way of saying that is do we expect income for the biennium to come in late to cover this, or is there actually a deficit after all of that's accounted for?
Let's see the easiest way to deal with this. I think that in our current situation, it's a cash flow issue, that we are going to manage the budget to get within the authority that we have plus the special appropriation set aside in the EBA. But what this really alludes to, which is, I think, even more important than trying to avoid... I mean, I think it's a good thing to avoid having to come in or borrow money.
Yes.
I think that's a good thing. But what's even more important, far more important, is that the systems we have and the ways that we've developed to deal with our cash flow inextricably combine budget issues with cash flow issues and confuse the state of the books and hamper our ability to come to you and to say where we are with respect to the budget. So the most important thing is that we
develop the processing and the balances that permit us to separate cash flow issues from budget, true budget issues, and can report to you on a much more real-time basis, or much more current, it's never really real-time, on a much more current basis,
an accurate basis,
what our true budget position is, without mixing in cash flow issues. And there are a lot of steps that we need to take to do that. Going on a true accrual basis on expenditures is one. Another is to get the workarounds in the system that we've put in to try to manage cash out of the system. And some of those are processing issues, and some of them are balance issues. But that's the far more important thing, is to get those, to separate those two things, like any business would separate its, you know, is the fiscal condition of the budget, of the business, in jeopardy, or is it simply a cash flow issue? You need to be able to sort those two things out.
And we're grateful to see these changes being made. And
yeah.
In the past, regardless of the size of this agency, it was kind of like, just the money will be there, spend, and then at the very end, oops, go to the legislature, we're a little short. Can we borrow a couple hundred million or 80 million? And that's no way to run a business, even though it's not a profit-making business. It is a business. It's business practices. And to see implemented business practices like you would see in a $10 billion biennial agency is very refreshing. We appreciate the effort that's gone on, tremendous amount of work. Let's continue.
And just to appreciate some of the work of the staff and some of the other parts of state government, it is more complicated than a business because we're part of a bigger entity.
Yeah.
We're not an independent business to ourselves. We can't just go to the bank and say, consolidate all our funds into one account at the end of every day. It doesn't work that way when you're part of a bigger entity.
Thank you. You know, I completely agree with the point you're making. I'm a whole lot less concerned about whether you have to go to the treasurer and borrow something from him in order to tide you over at the end of the year because your cash hasn't, your income hasn't come in yet. I'm a whole lot more worried about if you're spending beyond the budget and don't know it.
Yeah.
That would bother me a whole lot more. And the reason I say it that way is that we can make our own internal policies on how it is we move money between accounts in order to balance the daily funds out so that the banks will cash our checks. That's an easier task to deal with than the one in which we are spending money we don't know we've spent. And that's a completely different kind of problem.
And we've had both issues, and that's exactly what I need the confidence, and you need the confidence of where we are on a monthly basis in our fiscal picture.
Yeah.
And when we have that, I think that we will have the information that then we can make the kinds of financial decisions that we need to make, whether that is about a loan, a working capital loan for cash flow, because you know in a month that money is coming in. The issue is when we haven't known that, and that's what we are developing, and our ability to be successful as an agency is for each of our divisions to be able to understand where they are in terms of their budget and be able to manage that. And it ties into the next item on the agenda, which is the forecasting piece, because this isn't just about the fiscal issues. It's also about the fact that what we do is we take care of people who have needs, and that we don't just turn people away when they have problems, and our ability to be able to anticipate what the needs are in communities and be able to respond to them. We need to not only have accurate financial capabilities, but we need to accurately be able to understand what the human needs are and to be able to balance those things out.
I think you said what I said, only more succinctly, maybe more bluntly. The next item was the budget to actual work, the work the budget to actual committee is doing. And we're on a third version of these reports coming directly out of the system. We've made some adjustments to them for institutions and for COPs that are helpful. I don't mean to say that we didn't do this before. I think the issue within the agency was that we did them, but they were done by division. They were done on different formats at different levels of quality of, and they were very difficult to roll up into a true picture of the agency to show to the director. We have a very ambitious goal here. Ultimately, the goal is to be able to put on the director's desk and ultimately, obviously, on your desks, and however you want them, where we are every month, as soon as possible at the end of every month. And we have a long way to go to do that in terms of getting the workarounds out of the systems and getting accruals done, but to at least start having these reports and delivering them to the director and the division heads and to them having conversations, which Bruce is now starting with division heads about how do we manage to and how do we hold people accountable to manage spending to get to a goal by the end of the biennium. We have started that, and we've identified a lot of places where we have misalignments between budget and the way we account for things. We are starting to run into some workload issues about how we're going to fix all those things and what do we have to prioritize first. But we're started on the path, and ultimately, I believe we're going to run into systems issues, but we're going to do what we can to fix what we have within the current system. We're going to start through the business planning process, which we'll talk about here in a minute, to try to push our current systems as far as we can push them and then develop a plan in the long run to really getting on a current basis.
Which of these do you want to emphasize? You have five pages, and we're on page one, so which of these would you like to emphasize?
Well, let's very quickly maybe just recognize some of the work that's been done. The code of conduct work has been done. It's incorporated into the training of new employees as well. We had an effort with all employees of the two sides of the office. Much of the quality staff work has been done in terms of getting things up to speed. We've already started some movement around of offices to better meet the needs of the agency as a result of some of this work. You can ask me any. I think one thing I should mention on the payment symposium, since it came up at the meeting yesterday, is they had scheduled a meeting for the December 19th, and now I guess due to the holidays they've decided to move it to early January. So that meeting is scheduled. That question came up yesterday in the meeting. On the rest of these accounts receivable and recovery, there is actually some updates on this, and that, like that one thing that says in progress is now done. I think the key here is both on this and on the settlements, which is on the next page, is that we've already seen some result of these efforts in increased recoveries and as well as accelerating some of the settlement processes that we've had with the counties. A lot of those things were already happening, and we're seeing the results of that in the rebalance process on the revenue side.
Could you comment on what's going on as far as assuring accuracy of the bills that the state receives and pays from hospitals, providers, others?
I really should have Trish talk about that in more detail. I guess what I know of it, maybe Bruce knows more than I, that some of that's been contract, they've had a contract out, which I can't remember the name of the firm, to add to what we've been doing on that. And they've had some results from that already. I know revenue's been received. I don't have the specifics on that right off the top of my head.
I believe it's 15% commission to a private organization that audits bills based on what they recover back, and that's in addition to what is being done in-house, but that there is an effort being made to try and assure that the bills that are received are accurate and the money that's being paid is what's actually owed, which is very important.
Absolutely. That's I mean, that's an important financial function, is our payment accuracy and recovery unit, and looking at, actually, that's some of the infrastructure that we're looking to enhance in terms of making investments. We believe that by making some investments in that, it actually is very cost-effective, pays for itself.
And so I think the two most important things that are left, other than Bruce wants to talk about the forecasting procedures, and that is to minimize this other stuff because a lot of work has gone into it. But I think the things that will show up in you that you will notice is the mapping that we're doing under the policies and procedures group and how that's leading up to a business planning process beginning in the next year. We are mapping out all of our systems, both the IT systems that are that we use to do our financial processes, and I think they at one point had identified 45 systems. Now they're getting more sophisticated, and they're saying, well, this one isn't really a system, it's an interface. That's
what's
not
the difference?
Well, an interface lets one system talk to the other system, I guess.
A distinction without a difference.
But anyway, and we had a big meeting. We had a bunch of charts up on the wall just 2 hours ago in the meeting of the steering committee. But all of that's leading up to a business planning process to where we look at those systems and the current proposed changes to those systems and really try to look what this system really ought to look like. And we try to benchmark what it is we're doing now, what results we're getting out of that, what benchmarks we really ought to, or I guess that's called baselining. That's baselining. And then you benchmark what it is you really want it to be. And we have an RFP that is almost ready to go. I think it's going out at the end of the week. We've had some preliminary conversations with people that do this work. We've had some really great volunteer help from John Ramsey, who's a CEO who's really, in his life, he's now retired, has been through this process a number of times in many firms that he's worked for, and has really been a big help. We've had the help of John Radford from DAS, and so we're very close to issuing an RFP to bring in a consultant to help us work through this process and to really develop some metrics around where we want to be in every one of our work units, to redesign the system and to really meet the needs that and the vision that we'll establish through that process. So we expect that RFP to hit the streets, I guess is the word, on early next week. I think it's at the AG's office right now. We're making the final adjustments to it.
Great.
So that's where we are.
Excellent. So
and you wanted to talk about that.
Representative Barnhart.
Well, Mr. Chair, I was simply going to note that this is an enormously different, more systematic, and a sensible kind of approach to the issues that they're dealing with, as compared to what we got a year plus ago when we suddenly realized that we had a gigantic deficit to deal with. And I appreciate very much the work that you've done so far on this process.
Chair Richardson, Representative Barnhart, thank you. We have we've got a great staff that when kind of given the charge and the right help and leadership from people like Jim and others, we're, I think, able to do great things.
Okay. Yeah. Did you have any comments before we transition into forecasting, or did you want to do that? So
I think that's the next piece, which asked Judy Moore Peterson to come up. But as I was indicating, you know, the two pieces we have is to be able to one, you know, account for our finances. But if you recall, the deficit that we had, that $136 million deficit, 70% of that was made up of caseload changes that we hadn't anticipated, that the budget was built upon. 70% were caseload changes, 15% were changes in federal policy that affected us, and 15% were some errors that we had made in the past that we needed to create the systems to be certain we didn't get back to again. So certainly a piece of this has been creating the fiscal infrastructure. But another big piece of our business is, as I mentioned, 85% of what we do is done out in the community, delivering health care, taking care of seniors in nursing homes. And our ability to manage our business isn't just our ability to manage our finances. It's also to really understand what's happening in our communities, what the needs are. And so certainly another parallel piece of this has been about improving our ability to accurately forecast what our caseload needs are going to be. Now, saying that, I always have to give a disclaimer that it's right now. The governor next week is going to come out with a budget that's going to be based on caseload forecasts for 2.5 years from now, close to 3 years from now. And we, data from the last 6 months was used to do that. That's very difficult to be able to predict where we're going to be in our state economically 3 years from now, what changes in federal policy is going to happen or not happen, changes in state policy. So the forecasting piece is a difficult piece. The issue has been really twofold. It's been one to improve the methods by which we forecast, and we'll go through some of that. But I think equally as important has been our ability now to track forecasts. And that's a piece that I think we didn't pay as much attention to in the past, that we would forecast and then 6 months, a year later, we would reforecast. And now, as you'll see, what we're doing is both in our interactions with the legislature and the legislative fiscal office, as well as internally with each of our programs, we're not doing... we're not just forecasting, but we're tracking month by month the actuals as they come in as compared to what was forecast. And that gives us a sense of are things going as forecast? Are we falling off of the curve one way or another, under or over? And then it provides us an opportunity to be able to look at what are those factors so we can either make programmatic adjustments, budgetary adjustments, come and talk with policymakers about what's happening in our communities and what some of the needs are so that there aren't the kinds of surprises, that we sort of know what's happening and are able to predict that. And so
by doing it, you're actually increasing the confidence that the legislature has that you're doing all that you can do instead of just showing up with bad news saying, oh, guess what?
Well, we're increasing that confidence, and this really is inextricably linked with our budget.
Right.
Because once again, our budget is driven by the needs in our communities, what's happening in the fact that 17% of our population doesn't have health care means more people are coming onto the Oregon Health Plan. We need to be able to respond to that in a variety of ways. So we've really spent a lot of effort. We've, number one, increased our oversight of the process. We now have a group that we're working with at the Department of Administrative Services with some of their forecasters, the economic forecasters, and some of the other experts who are working with us on some of our methodologic issues, and we meet regularly with them and review the forecasts. The forecasts are now, before we issue a forecast, myself and Lindsay Ball review that and the methods, and we sort of jointly sign off on that to be able to provide an enhanced level of oversight. We've created a number of community advisory groups and brought in a number of community experts to help look at and advise us in the process. We've brought in community providers who can perhaps be able to let us know some of the trends that they're seeing in communities before we ourselves actually see that the cases occur in our caseloads. We're looking at creating a better way of forecasting, of being able, not just to be able to forecast caseloads, but quite frankly, I think where we need to move towards is to be able to look at the need in our communities and be able to not just forecast what our caseloads are, but to be able to accurately gauge how well we as an agency are doing in meeting what the needs are. We may be following a caseload forecast, but we may not be meeting the needs of the population in a community. So we've been doing that. Let me turn things over to Judy to just, at a very high level, talk to you about some of the methodologic issues around what we've done in terms of the forecasting.
For the record, my name is Judy Moore Peterson, and I'm the manager for the forecasting group at the Department of Human Services. As Bruce mentioned, we have been working very diligently on exploring alternative methods, additional tools, et cetera. We've worked with the DAS review team. We've also contacted forecasting experts in other states, as well as within our state, from private industry, as well in other parts of state government, to get their advice on improvements that we could do, different methods that we could try to use, different processes that we could put in place to help improve our forecasting methods. So at a very high level, some of the things that we've been able to implement thus far is incorporating the use of more timely data into our forecasting. There's little we can do about getting the most comprehensive data available to do the forecast, but what we can do is use the more recent data to kind of do a check to make sure that it's matching with what we're forecasting, so that if it isn't matching with what we're forecasting, then we can make those last-minute tweaks and changes so that it more closely aligns with what we think is going on in real time. For the technical tools and software, we're in the process of constructing a data warehouse of all the clients and services within the Department of Human Services. That has turned into quite a major task because, as you can imagine, there's a lot of different databases and warehouses, everything from spreadsheets to huge mainframes that contain all this data from all the various services that DHS provides, as well as all the clients. And the reason that we're doing that is because there could be a client over here who's receiving services temporary assistance for needy families, but is also receiving a child welfare or addiction services, et cetera. And those two systems, they exist separately. And if we're trying to predict where those are going to go, then it's important to understand what those interactions are, what those hydraulics, so to speak, are. So if you make a change over here, it's necessary to know where else that's going to have the impact. And right now, our systems do not allow us to do that. So we are in the process of doing that. It's very, very complicated. So we're probably about three-quarters of our way through. We've also gotten some additional software tools that allow us to do some systems modeling so that, as Bruce was mentioning, instead of just tracking the caseloads, we're looking at some software tools that will allow us to bring in and analyze the effects of other kind of factors like the population growth, like economic changes, job rates, poverty rates, all the demographic changes that are occurring. That will allow us to also analyze that kind of the overall effects that will help us do a better job of predicting our caseloads, as well as predicting what the long-term needs are, or if there are policies that folks are wanting to put into place. It will enhance our ability to be able to predict what those effects will be on our caseloads and on the general population. The implementing new and or revised methods. One of the things that was that the DAS review team suggested is that we start producing ranges or not technically, but confidence intervals. The further out you go, the broader the range is that you're likely to fall in. And so we've just implemented that with this last forecast. If you receive the forecast book or the summary, you should see those little dotted lines that indicate the further out you go, the more risk there is on a.
And I'm hoping that will actually be a conversation that we have through the legislative session, because certainly one of the issues that we've seen is that we put together a two-year budget for the agency as if we know that 2 years from now we're going to have 470,322 people on the Oregon Health Plan. And our ability to do that 2 years out, it is very difficult, and I think what we need to have is a better understanding of what how we need to budget to the either confidence or lack of confidence that we have in some of our caseloads. We've seen a dramatic increase in child welfare caseloads due to the increase in methamphetamine abuse. You know, we weren't able to predict that three years ago, and yet that's now we have that as a both a human and a budgetary consequence, and we need to be able to look at a way that we can both budget for the department in a way that reflects some of the lack of confidence that we have as we get further and further out in some of our caseloads, as well as some of the changes in federal policy. I think we're finally at a place where we can now, we can better understand when policy is made, the effects that it will have on our caseloads a year and year or two out. That was actually one of the biggest issues we had in the inaccuracy of the couple of forecasts a year or two ago, was that there were some policy changes made, but we really couldn't predict what the effects those had on caseload. I think we're much better, and the reason we're much better is because now if you go to page 11 and page 12 as an example, this is what we're looking at every month. We're sitting down both as an executive team in the agency, as well as we've got a caseload group with legislators, and we meet with LFO and BAM and a group of legislators, Representative Richardson, Senator Winters, then Representative and soon to be Senator Avakian, and Senator Mona Sanderson. We meet monthly, and this is what we look at program by program. We look at what the forecast showed and where we are sort of under over that forecast. The most recent 3 months, August, September, and October, those are sort of statistically calculated numbers. So some of the information Judy was talking about, we often don't know the number of people in the health plan in October because it takes often 3 months. There's some complicated procedures about retroactive eligibility that oftentimes someone who presents in for a service in November may not become officially eligible for the plan until February, but the eligibility is retroactive to November. So we've done a better job of tracking that.
I want to comment on the change that you've made in showing a parameter as that kind of spreads in your forecasting as time goes on. What this will do is allow the policymakers that control the budgets, the ways and means people, to make decisions exactly about where they're going to fund DHS. Mm-hmm. And in the past, by saying we're using last year's data, we're coming out of a recession, so things are getting better, but because we're using that, we're going to project caseloads as if we were still in a recession, that causes those in ways and means to say, now, wait a second. this is what they say they need, but they don't really need that kind of money. And so now we're going to try and anticipate what you really are going to need in determining a budget, and so we can't rely on the figures. But because of the changes in your forecasting and the idea of here's a high and a low, it allows the Ways and Means people to say, okay, if we're going to fund this based on a low estimate, then it's with an understanding that a year and a half from now, we may have to have a special session to deal with this, and it won't be saying, where in the world did DHS go wrong because they said we only needed this amount, but now it's this amount. And so it will actually give ranges because you can't give guarantees, only estimates, but they're well-based. And so I think that actually will, again, help improve the confidence that we have in the information received from DHS and allow decisions to be made that we have to live with, but at least they're anticipating variables that you can't foresee.
And I think a piece of it has also been, I think a change in the conversation. I think as you've seen, whether it be around the forecasting piece or around the fiscal piece, a lot of these issues are really complicated issues. And I think what we've been able to do is establish some good working relationships with the staff at LFO and BAM, different groups of legislators, so that, you know, the meetings we have now are very different after we've met, you know, every 2 months around caseload, and now we can go and have a caseload meeting, and it's about 45 minutes because people are familiar with the information, they know how to read the reports, we've had a lot of questions answered, and I think that ability to have some familiarity with the information and to be able to have, to me, what's, you know, some, you know, educated, transparent, and accurate conversations makes for better policy.
That change that came with your coming into your position has had a tremendous impact, because the word transparency is huge. In the last year, when I've asked for information, I've always gotten it. Previous to that, it was like pulling teeth. It was like it was a game that was being played between the legislature and DHS on, if you ask the question just right, you might get just right answer, and if you didn't quite do it, then you get general information, and it was like cross-examination through emails. And that's not the case anymore, and that's very much appreciated, because by having data, then questions can come up and it takes more of your time, but they get answered, and then they don't have to be asked over and over again.
You know, there was a comment earlier about gaming the system, and you know, I'm not going to comment about gaming the system, but we're certainly not going to game the legislature.
That's the key.
If I could make three comments, and I'll keep them real brief. First of all, I absolutely concur with the chair that your leadership on this set of issues has just been tremendous and should be greatly appreciated by the legislature. It's a human service delivery organization. So, you know, and this group of issues that you deal with on a daily basis are some of the most important decisions and some of the most important issues that affect the quality of life of a great many Oregonians. If the financial data, the forecasting data, is out of sync, the legislature doesn't get to make good decisions. And it's just that simple. And the surprises that have occurred in the past during legislative sessions have had a tremendous impact in terms of just the dynamics of how you fund some of these issues, and it becomes a lot more crisis management orientation than planning out a logical way to serve the most needy people in Oregon. And so this is probably some of the most important stuff I've seen in the human services field since I've been in the legislature. The one other comment I'm going to make, just as somebody that's headed out, this is real good in terms of for a couple year forecasting. The next thing that somehow all of state government needs to go get to, as we talk about like rainy day funds, we also should talk about deferred investments. For example, the crisis that we're working through with the state hospital. You know, hopefully when we get a new system in place, will realize that the new hospital is going to wear out someday and that it's going to have increased costs. It would be incredible if we could set money aside, you know, at the time that we're building the new one for the replacement. One huge problem with your agency is information services and the computers and those types of things. And that's deferred maintenance that if we could have a systematic way of budgeting, long-term planning on how we're going to update our information systems, how we're going to do the deferred maintenance on a lot of other things other than just buildings. The issue on the community infrastructure that we've underfunded for as long as I've been here, where we have to realize that's just a deferred cost that's going to come back and bite us at some point that we have to make up. So if we could somehow get to a more long-term way of looking at our budgeting, I think it would be real helpful. Not just, well, we'll set a bunch of money aside for an emergency, but let's set some money aside for things that we absolutely know are going to need to be replaced or need to be maintained. And anyway, I'm done with my soapbox, but you're doing a hell of a job.
Well, thanks. I mean, it's just the foundation upon which I think we need to build on. And the next piece is not only that piece, but it's also on the programmatic side. I mean, once we have established the sort of fiscal accountability and understanding, I think we need to also have the same issues around understanding better the needs in our communities and our ability to meet them and what the value of our services. And this really just sets the stage for that next piece as well, as that's the other part of the sort of infrastructure.
Thank you. And, you know, Mr. Chair and Representative Hansen, expanding this even further, the better we understand your costs and the long-term issues, the better we can make good policy decisions in areas that you don't control at all. I'm thinking about education, highway building, and a whole bunch of other things. Because those decisions impact what your successor down the road is going to have to spend money on.
Well, and the decisions we're making today impact many of those other programs.
Yes.
Our investment or lack of investment in such things as mental health care and substance abuse have real cost. I mean, when we talk about forecasting and budgeting, that has real implications in the Department of Corrections,
yes,
in our schools as well. And so we need to not only develop the ability to look at the cross-program implications right now within our agency, but actually within how we look at entire state policy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that besides informing good public policy making, which indeed it does, I agree that what you are doing is so important, vital, and long overdue, but it really will go a long way to help restore the confidence of the taxpaying citizens in not only your agency, but the governmental process overall, and hopefully even down line the legislature.
That's the goal.
That's the goal. Thank you.
Move that up to the second priority.
By the way, you know, Representative Hansen, who will not be coming back, he touched on something that those of us that are coming back really need to focus on as we talk in various meetings about what the agendas are for this next session, and that is the need for a rainy day fund, because we have gone through in the last 4 years some real hard times worth enough money because of the change in the economy to maintain the programs that people desperately rely on. And if now we have a booming economy and great forecasts, but this is the time for us to anticipate the next recession. Because if we don't, then we're derelict in our duties, because it's going to come. And when it comes, if we just merely have continued to expand, to spend whatever we've got, then when it hits, whoever of us are still here or whoever's in here are going to have to deal with the same situation again, where we have inadequate resources to deal with the shortfall. And if we're wise now, then when revenues go down, we'll have money that we can make the difference in, to backfill, so that people who are desperately relying on these services do not just get told, sorry, we can't do that, we can't help you.
Well put, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Yep. If I could add just one other item on that. One of the problems as we go through that type of a recession that hit us three bienniums in a row, as we try to juggle, then we end up doing things like cutting back on training.
Yeah.
Cutting back on things that, you know, the air rates that you're dealing with now in a lot of different programs are probably because of decisions we made a couple of years back in terms of ratcheting down training and things that were available, which, you know, is another form of infrastructure. But as we make those cutbacks, which become real painful, and we do those so we can extend the services, but we just build in a time bomb that we have to pay for later in a different, you know, with air raid instead of putting the money into training. And so it's kind of a total loss situation that hopefully we can figure out a way to get out of. But the first building block is accurate financial data.
That's members of our committee, this is probably our concluding meeting. The assignment we had was House Interim Task Force on DHS Review, and we have been reviewing you and what you've been doing.
Sufficiently reviewed.
Forthright, and we want you to know that it's already been expressed. The progress that's being made is exemplary for the state, and the transparency, the openness, the willingness to respond to criticism has not always been there, but it's there now, and that is of great value. The sensitive case review process showed that as well, because we were up there in this meeting going up through all this, and it wasn't hearing this defense, which is so counterproductive, defending the agency at all costs. It was trying to intelligently look at what's working, what's not, why did this happen, evaluating in a logical and intelligent manner what took place, and then taking the lessons from that and making changes where necessary to help improve the entire agency and the delivery of services, which is what the agency is trying to accomplish. The work you're doing on fiscal accountability, and with your assistance, Mr. Scherzinger, thank you so much all for what you're doing. The forecasting reforms and the changes that are taking place, Judy, are tremendous. The procedure evaluations, which it takes a lot of time, and they've got a lot of agencies, a lot of offices, and it's going to take time for these things to make their way to the front lines in a way where you have the feeling of support by your members, so that it's not just dictating we're making these changes, but where you're actually benefiting from the experience of your line workers, changing processes, giving support, training, and all of those things to enable them to do their job better. One thing we discussed at the very beginning of this meeting was the possibility of using SpeakRite. And if that would cut 2 hours a day off of the time that has to be spent at a typewriter a computer terminal for a worker, that allows that time to be spent working on cases and working with individuals and children and families, doing the things that need to be done and not merely jumping through hoops and accomplishing paperwork. So all of these things are very positive. The increased training and accountability is very worthwhile. We will give a positive report to the Speaker of the House and the others that are concerned in this building about what's taking place with DHS. And we say press on, and we'll do all that we can to support you.
Together, thank you.
Thank you.
Are there any closing remarks before we terminate this task force? Representative, wasn't it?
I wish Representative Hansen good travel and safe, good happiness and health. I've enjoyed sitting beside him in all the Ways and Means committees, and I think I learned something.
I'm sure you did.
No. That has institutional
memory.
Thanks
for the kind sentiment.
So we will miss your sage advice. Anyway, thank you all for your participation and your help, and we look forward to working with you in the upcoming session.